volume for this room as it fills with people. So we may be doing some testing, playing of Rolling Stone music, other entertainment during the session that will be odd, but it's designed to figure out an appropriate sound level. If you're having any problems on the sound, the crew over there at the right with the two hands raised, if you just wave at them, if you're having some problems on sound, they'll come over and check, and then we'll try to make adjustments for you. Okay, there's some kind of assisted listening facility. All right, that's number one. Number two, members, there's a little switch right under the lights in front of you. The microphone's on with red and off with nothing in terms of color. Anyway, let's start off. Let's establish a quorum, starting with Mr. Natoli.
Natoli, here.
Eisenberg, present.
Fiorini, here.
Nordhoff, present.
Okay, Mr. Johnston was present with us earlier. And I think is going to be here a bit later during the meeting. Ms. Gray is traveling, and we have a vacancy. Let me just give a very brief staff report. For those of you who did not read any newspaper this morning in California, you'll want to take a look at the report that was issued by the State Water Resources Control Board yesterday at approximately noon. It's the draft flow criteria report they were mandated to produce in the water legislation of last year, given only 9 months to do it, which is a short time frame. I'm halfway through my copy. It's about 300 pages, and it is bound to be the subject of intense discussion and its relevance, because the report is really, after they take action on August 3rd, which is their intended date for action, that report comes to us for our review and consideration, and it goes to the Bay Delta Conservation Planning folks for their review and consideration. You can read in newspaper articles today and a lot of the water blogs that are starting to comment, and I know it'll come as a shock to you, but there are diametrically opposed views of what the document says, depending on who you are, where you are, and what your preferences would be. It's very comprehensive. It's quite interesting, and it also has some very valuable historical information on the board's past and current activities on flow standards, dating back to 1961, if memory serves, which is a long time, where they started off by doing nothing, their report said. Anyway, that's the first thing. The second thing is, as you know, we have a vacancy. Mr. Bruce Collins resigned. I haven't heard yet what the governor's going to do on the appointments. Speculation is that that appointment, as with all other appointments, as with 9,876 other things, will be tied up in the budget negotiations. And no one I know is predicting a ready resolution of that anytime soon, although the session, legislative session, is supposed to end at the end of August, and so there will be at least some prodding of action until then. Then the last matter, although, you know, not really directly before us, the water bond either will be on the November ballot, won't be on the November ballot, or we won't know for a while, depending. The governor has suggested, and three of the four legislative leaders have agreed, and one has been general in comments as opposed to taking a position on the issue. Three of the legislative leaders have agreed that it should be put over for, I think, a two-year period to be conducted in 2014. And if you read newspaper stories and the blogs, they're full of observations on that, too. That is my report, other than the fact that the staff is working hard, and we will talk about various things on the agenda as we go through. But I would just like to note that Mrs. Sward, a famous marina owner in the Delta, gave me a book, Paddle Wheels Days in California, reporting on the very first battle between paddle wheelers in this area. And undoubtedly, the battle was sponsored by the predecessor owner of your marina, right, Ms. Ward? No, but anyway, interesting books, as there are a lot of good books about the Delta. This is Paddle Wheel Days in California. All right, let us go ahead. Mr. Grindstaff is traveling and is under orders from his family to take something approximating a vacation. So, Mr. Coolidge, if you would lead off for us, please, on the executive officer's report.
Chair.
Okay.
In Joe's defense, something approximating a vacation means he is on a trip with U.S. water officials touring Australia and learning lessons from the drought, which involve radically reducing water use. So he's going to come back with all kinds of suggestions and influence. Also with him is Member Gray and the state drought coordinator, Wendy Martin, and I think two or three other state officials, as well as from around the rest of the country. The executive officer's report, legislative and legal update. You have in your packets, members, a discussion of legislation affecting water, as well as a description of a bill by Assemblymember Huffman, AB 2092. Kurt Miller, the Ledge Director, is available for questions if you had any.
All right, let me just see. Any questions on the two bills that are before us, Mr. Huffman's AB 2092 and Senate Bill 1450? Members, questions? Okay. Information only, but if you have questions for Mr. Miller today, he's sitting out there in the audience.
All right, okay. Mr. Chair. Item 4B was a follow-up to questions from the last Stewardship Council meeting. They also are in your packet. Oh, I'm sorry. It was legislative and legal update. Councillor, the legal update.
Yeah, thank you. You skipped the most important part, of course.
It's all a matter of perspective.
It really is. It really. I'm learning that day by day in this job. Thank you very much for the opportunity here. And a couple things just to mention, which are obvious, but I'll mention them anyway. Our statute requires us to meet twice a year in the Delta. And this is our first meeting here, and I think on behalf of all the board members, I'll at least say thank you very much for hosting this and suggesting this venue, and we will have at least one other this year in the Delta.
Although we're also moving to West Sacramento City Hall for future meetings.
For the future, right.
And I can't remember, Mr. McGowan, you may know, is that within the statutory Delta? Secondary zone to
right.
The Delta, so in some sense of the word, we may be having all of our meetings within the Delta.
Fantastic.
Okay.
The second thing is I just wanted to mention just a kind of an internal logistical matter. We are going to benefit here shortly from the services of a legal intern that is being lent to us from the Department of Water Resources. We're very resource short. And we greatly appreciate the Department of Water Resources lending us this young lady by the name of Rebecca Coleman, who may or may not be out in the audience. She'll be starting with us.
There was someone who raised their hand at head level and went like this.
Was Rebecca? Oh,
back.
Hi, Rebecca.
Ah.
Thanks for coming. We
yes.
appreciate it. We'll be talking to you early next week and excuse me, setting you up with some fantastically interesting assignments. The first of which, though, will be to come up with kind of a review and status update on Delta-related litigation.
Excuse me, Chris, but with all due respect, Rebecca, couldn't we get a non-lawyer?
Pardon me?
Could we not have gotten a non-lawyer? I mean, we've got a lot of lawyers here. Can you do work outside the legal field, too, Rebecca?
We can all do that.
Okay.
In fact, we may invite her to actually give a presentation at our next meeting. So I just wanted, first of all, to thank you, Rebecca, and DWR for lending us your able assistance. So with that, I will turn it back over to you.
Thanks. And part of the reason Mr. Stevens is so happy is that having Rebecca on board doubles the size of the legal staff.
And we know how difficult Mr. Stevens is to get along with, so there you are. Okay, yes, we are very pleased with your addition. Welcome. Thank you.
All right. Follow-up information from last meeting is in your packet as item 4B, the answers to questions. This is a practice that we started at the first meeting of the council.
Which is a good one, I think.
And we'll keep a running track. These are posted on the web as well. There are no questions on that. Item 4B, attachment 1, responsive to a question at the last meeting, which is part of the new assignment for the Delta Stewardship Council was to serve as the successor agency to the Bay Delta Authority, the CalFed Bay Delta Program. And I think it was Councilmember Nordoff who was asking, so what does that really mean when you say things right. are transferred over? The short answer is that three major program areas came over. Program performance and tracking, which under CalFed and the authority was an evolving effort to really track and be able to explain progress or lack of progress on each of the specific projects and programs that fell under the CalFed record of decision. That may change somewhat as it comes over, and the Stewardship Council's purview is more Delta-focused than CalFed's, which included upstream and watersheds, as well as a lot of work in Southern California. So that will be an evolving program, but it is an attempt to make sure that folks have a very easy and transparent way of finding what money is spent on what projects and programs in the Delta, and then matching that with performance measures so that we can actually see and chart progress, and people will begin to understand either they're getting value for their money or we are going to have to start shifting into other projects and programs that do provide value. The second one is strategic planning. This is an effort to coordinate among all of the at least state agencies. Under CalFed, it was the state and federal agencies for their actions and activities in the Delta. And then lastly, now the Delta Science Program, formerly the CalFed Science Program, an effort to provide sound, best available science that can be a common reference point as we approach the Delta.
Okay. Any questions on that? Okay, I forgot to mention one other thing, ladies and gentlemen. We had a tour before this meeting, starting in Sacramento and looking at various facilities and locations and so on, ending with lunch at Heartland Nursery, and we had a good time and followed the law by not having any more than a minority of us in a van at one time, as required by law in these peculiar arrangements. And the other thing is we had a very nice lunch at Heartland Nursery, and those of you who have not gone there to see it, it's worth a trip. The other thing is I forgot to mention that if people want to talk to us on to the council, there are a pile of blue forms. I think some are in back and some are up at front. If you just fill it out, that way we can match up your spelling, and if you print, as we appreciate you doing, we'll correctly reflect your name in the summary minutes of the meeting and hopefully get it right. That would be useful. Also, I believe available and for distribution on the table is a copy of the enabling legislation with an index. And, you know, a lot of you have been following the law, but there is, in fact, back there a copy of the full statute that created this body and the other, the Delta Conservancy, and changed the responsibilities of other agencies like Delta Protection Commission. And that is in the back, and it's indexed, so you can try to get through whatever it is, 29 or 30 pages of text. And we're going to put that in a little better format for people to utilize. Okay. In that case, let's go to item number 5 on the agenda, which is our consent calendar. And I would note under our minutes of the June 24th, 25th meeting, members, that there was a redline correction version of the agenda. There were some grammatical changes. And so if you go through your bucket, or if you have filed the bucket material in your agenda, you will find minutes with a cap in red at top that says revised July 19, 2010 agenda. I think Mr. Stevens and others were working on these changes, and it reflects more, I gather, more accurately what we actually did. Okay, so on the minutes of the previous meeting, and particularly the suggested revisions, any comments or questions by members? Comments or questions? Okay, Mr. Natoli moves. Mr. Nordhoff second. Let's call the roll. Mr. Natoli.
Aye.
Eisenberg, aye.
Fiorini, aye.
Okay, unanimous on that. Okay, we also have the procedural stuff we started at our very first meeting, I think in April 1st of this year, which is the conflict of interest provisions. And Mr. Coolidge, is that, no, that's Mr. Stevens, right? Mr. Stevens, if you would talk to us about file item 5B.
I'm not going to jump in over Chris ever again.
Okay, got it. No. Okay.
Yeah, again, this is a housekeeping matter at this point. This is the final adoption of our first regulatory rulemaking package, the conflict of interest code that's required of all state and local agencies. We brought this before you on a couple previous occasions. We put this out for public comment and gave copies to affected employees. We didn't receive any comments by the end of the close of the comment period. And now what we have to do is take a final vote, and we'll package all the paperwork together, send it off to the Fair Political Practices Commission, and within about 60 days, we should have our first rule on the books, which will be the Conflict of Interest Code, pursuant to which you'll all file your Form 700s next year.
Which we've already filed them anyway.
You had to anyway. So.
Okay, let's see if there are questions on the conflict code by members. Any questions? Anyone in the audience like to talk to us on this issue? Okay, pleasure, motion? Mr. Natoli? Second, Mr. Fiorini. Call the roll, Mr. Natoli.
Natoli, aye.
Eisenberg, aye.
Fiorini, aye.
Nordhoff, aye.
Okay, conflict of interest approved for forwarding the FPPC unanimously. All right. Now, last is a notice item, I believe, Mr. Coolidge, on contracts. This is file item 5C.
Yes, this is actually a request from the Delta Science Program.
That's right. I'm
seeking
sorry.
Approval to accept federal and state funds. This is from other agencies who want to partner with our science program for work in the Delta and come with funding attached.
Okay, Mr. Dom, if you would come up here just in case there are questions, I'd appreciate this. Oh, okay, Ms. Hastings. Okay. No, just sit right down there. All right, sit down right there. And you press the button on the microphone to turn it on. Okay. Now, my understanding is that although this technically increases the budget, it only increases it based on reimbursement from, at this time, federal agencies, although conceivably in the future, other state agencies as well. Is that correct?
We are receiving some funding from DWR, a state agency as well. So it's federal and state.
Okay. And if the if the funding is not received, the expenditures are not going to happen.
We will have no expenditures
correct?
Without receiving the funding.
Okay. Members questioned on this issue? Mr. Nordhoff.
If you will, Lauren, could you go over the three abbreviations under requested action? USGS, is that Coastal Service?
Oh, yes, we probably should have
Geodetic.
Written those out. Sorry that we didn't catch that. That's the United States Geological Survey.
Okay.
USBR is United States Bureau of Reclamation. And NMFS is NOAA Fisheries or National Marine Fisheries Service.
Otherwise known as?
NMFS.
NMFS. Yeah, for reasons that
we say the NMFS yes, right. as yes. NMFS.
Okay.
Thank it you. Is part of the endless alphabet soup of our lives. Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Anyone in the audience like to speak to this issue? Okay. Motion. Mr. Natoli.
So moved. Second.
Mr. Fiorini, you call the roll. Mr. Natoli.
Aye.
Eisenberg, aye.
Fiorini, aye.
Nordhoff, aye.
Okay. Approved 4-0. Then. Okay, now, that takes us through your items, Mr. Coolidge, I believe. Okay, interim lead scientist report, Mr. Dom. Mr. Dom said he's dressed in his field attire this morning since he was on the tour. Yeah, if you would.
Yes, dressed in field attire and dressed in the new T-shirt that my older daughter sent me from South Africa because I was unable to go to see the World Cup where she spent most of the
So
past
she got
six
you
weeks.
A T-shirt anyway.
So I got a T-shirt out of it anyway. Okay, I have a few items that I wanted to bring to the attention of the council. I've wanted to give you brief updates on the Delta Independent Science Board, which you approved at your last meeting, and also give you an update on where we are with the 2010 proposal solicitation package. The Delta Independent Science Board, we're in the process of planning their initial meeting. It'll probably be in September sometime. We're in the process of figuring out a date for them to meet. We do have posted on the website now nice biographies and photos of each of the 10 individuals that were that were placed on the board, and I think they're eager and ready. If we can assemble them all in the United States, we should have an initial meeting here in, probably in September. Might be early October, but looks like it'll be September. Any questions on that?
I don't think so.
Okay. The proposal solicitation package, we've got 49 proposals. We've gone through the administrative review of those proposals.
These are the offerings that we put out with our approval 2 meetings ago, I guess, right?
That's correct. We're looking to fund in 4 different areas. I'll just remind you of those areas. It's fish ecology, food webs and contaminants, and linking hydrologic modeling with ecological modeling and developing decision support systems for decision making in the Delta. So those are the 4 theme areas. We received 49 proposals. We're in the process. We finished the administrative review. I think all but one are in condition to proceed with review. And we are now in the process of assigning external reviewers to review them. And we'll then be developing a panel that will also meet after the external reviews are completed to give us guidance on
what's your guess on final wrap-up date for all of this and approval?
The whole process, start to finish, will probably take through the rest of the calendar year.
Okay. All right.
And I think that we had about $31 million requested of about with about $8 million available for funding, so which is not uncommon for these kinds of solicitations. And then the third thing I wanted to bring to your attention is a change in status that will occur with the interim lead scientist, with me. My initial tenure to serve in this capacity was to be from July 2008 through June of 2010, so I have already overextended my welcome. But I am planning to try to continue to give you some assistance while we seek the new lead scientist. State statute requires that the new lead scientist be selected by the Independent Science Board, which has yet to meet. So the process, as you can see, is just in the early stages of beginning. So we'll have that be one of their early agenda items, and they'll start that process. But the soliciting of candidates, actual interviews of those candidates, selection process, negotiations, and getting on a person on board, I suspect will take probably through summer of 2011. My university, like many universities around the United States, is broke. So when I went back to them and said, could I buy back half my salary to continue to make sure that we have this transition go smoothly, they said, sure, we'll take your money. So that is exactly what's happened. And my plan for the fall will be to spend Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday here. When you all meet, I'll be here on that Thursday. My teaching has all been pretty much put on Fridays, and then I'll be back at my home institution Friday, Saturday, and then traveling back here on Sunday. So I'll have an interesting, frequent flyer, happy fall. So okay. I just wanted to alert the council to that change in status.
Good. Well, we're pleased that you were able to work out a little bit of an extension while we get this process in order to select a lead scientist, and we appreciate that very much. Questions, members, on that? Mr. Nordhoff.
Cliff, going back to the Independent Science Board meeting, will it be organized around a single theme? Will you and the members agree on the topics to be discussed in advance? Will it be a one-day meeting or multiple-day?
We're planning 2-day meetings, maybe in some cases going on to 3-day meetings. Actually, the next agenda item is to actually discuss the charge for the Independent Science Board and also the guidelines for their meetings. And so we are soliciting your input on that process. But yes, we are envisioning 2, maybe 3-day meetings for them. And there will be certainly a set agenda, and the way to set the agenda and the mechanism of setting the agenda is something that we tried to outline in both the guidelines and the charge.
Okay. Mr. Coolidge, did you have anything?
Not to this, but maybe Cliff, I know at UC Davis a couple of weeks ago, the national panel was in town for three days, 4 days of testimony. You were over there This is the federal science effort on the Delta. I didn't know if you wanted to give the members just a little update on the panel was out and what they talked about.
Yeah, the panel was here actually for 3 days. They actually met in Sacramento this time. They met at the Embassy Suites. They had 1 day of public meetings followed by, I think, a day of closed-door deliberations, and then I think they had a tour of the Delta on the third day. And so the public day, which is the 1 day that I attended where I can provide some insight.
Members, this is the panel that was set up at the suggestion of Senator Feinstein to review the two biological opinions that were the subject of litigation in the Fresno Federal District Court. And this was this the second of their meetings, I believe? They'd done a very preliminary review first, and then they've picked up some new duties, I gather.
Yeah, I think the actual formal request for the formation of the National Research Council panel came from the Department of Interior and the Department of Commerce. So they requested the National Academy of Sciences to constitute this panel, which they did. They met and have issued an initial report that had to do with possible operational changes or operational analysis of the BOs and the biological opinions and operation criteria. That one was issued a few weeks ago. This is their second meeting, and their second meeting was to focus on, basically the public meeting focused on two things, a discussion of the Bay Delta Conservation Plan in the morning, and then a discussion of other stressors that are present and acting in the system in the afternoon. So they had a series of presentations by a number of people involved in the BDCP process in the morning, followed by an afternoon in which they had four presentations of different individuals who have been addressing some of the issues of things like pesticide problems, nutrient loading issues, flow criteria, a variety of various other potential stressors that the system might see as background information for them as they begin to work on their next report. The one additional task that they've taken on that you mentioned that I think you're referring to is that they have been asked formally, I believe by the Department of Interior, maybe by both departments, to take on a review of the draft Bay Delta Conservation Plan when it is issued in November. And my understanding is that the panel has agreed to take on that charge.
Okay. All right. Why don't we go on to the next item, Mr. Dahm, if you would, please.
Okay. The next item is since our last meeting, have drafted two items for your review.
This is not for action today.
This is not for action. This is for information. In fact, what I'm here to do is to ask for your guidance and input. The two items that have been drafted are a charge for the Independent Science Board. It's about a page and a half document. We would really appreciate your input and comments on this document. We'd like to try to finalize this document and bring it back to you as an action item at one of your future meetings. But we do feel it's important that we have a clear charge for the Independent Science Board going forward. So that's the shorter of the two documents. The second document are guidelines for the Independent Science Board. In the guidelines, you'll actually find two appendices, a short appendix, which is the present draft charge. The second appendix, which is from our legal assistants and friends, which has to do with a lot of the kind of guidelines relative to meetings that you all have gone through yourselves. So guidelines about open meetings and basically how to conduct meetings and aspects of making sure these are transparent in public gatherings. And then in the early part of the document, the guidelines are basically addressing issues about selecting a chair and a co-chair, how to accept input, how to make decisions on agendas, how to interact with the council, how to interact with the Delta Science Program. And again, we're asking your input and assistance in crafting some guidelines, which we would like to then share with the Independent Science Board members for their input and feedback.
Okay. My assumption is that we'll probably wind up hearing the revised charge and documents in September. I could be wrong, might be August, but I think it's more likely to be September. And if we can do that prior to the meeting of the Independent Science Board, that would be great. We'll have to work with you on that possibility. Okay. Members, this is really the time for questions and comments on this. Mr. Nordhoff, did you?
Yeah, I don't know if it's premature, but in my experience, the scientific advisory boards or independent boards have I've found useful One in tackling topical issues, and another one in bringing up to speed and up to date on their specific areas of expertise. And there, I think, you know, you have to be fairly specific. One issue now in talking in the morning session is the Corps of Engineers plan to remove all vegetation from levees. And quite honestly, there's not an awful lot of evidence to support this, and it's going to be awfully expensive, billions of dollars. And it reminds me, in talking with an eminent physician just last week, he was saying a lot of things, movements in medicine, as an example, start on the basis of rumor. When I was young, somebody decided that it would be a good thing to remove tonsils, to do tonsillectomies, because children would get less sore throats. And everybody started doing that. And then when there was no benefit to that, everybody stopped doing it. And this sounds a little bit like that. You know, clearly, it seems to me that when you have a lot of loose stuff, if you can anchor it with root structure, things that are growing, it would seem to fix it there. And that would seem to be a good thing. And the cost of removing those, obviously you just can't cut off the trees and then have the roots rot and form perforations in the soil, which could be a real detriment. So something like that, I think if you could tee up the people in advance and look at the literature that's already been written in the field and then maybe talk about some personal examples to see if, in fact, there is any scientific basis for doing this that would be relevant to our levee system here in the Delta.
I think that's the kind of thing that the Independent Science Board should be charged to do. They should bring on topics that are of importance. They should bring in the differing opinions of people who have differing opinions on a topic such as this. And then quite often either issue a short report or a letter that basically lays out their sense and findings.
Uninformed debate would be a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, other questions? Let me just run through. This is just kind of miscellaneous. On the draft charge, I do suggest that you consider using the format we suggested for the interim plan, Delta plan of analysis of issues, or at least in part, because I think citing the legal authority for the Sciences Board's activity, consistent with all the other things we're doing, would be a useful thing to do. There are many mentions of the Independent Science Board in the statute, and their duties are enumerated, and so I just think that foundational point would be added.
That was actually our intent under that subheading, Delta Reform Act, was to actually
But I think you have not. I just have problems with some of the wording on your summarization of this kind of stuff. And one of the things we learned on the as we went through the other processes is if you lay out the authorizations first, the words of the summary tend to look a lot like the legal authorization as opposed to a description of it. And I'm just inclined to stick with the statute where it is useful, and directly relevant. And then the second was really a question. As you do a charge to the Independent Science Board, is there any utility to simultaneously thinking about the science program generally and the interagency ecosystem program, which is a related scientific endeavor? And in other words, as you do a charge for one entity, does it make sense to think about all of the others at the same time? I don't know the answer to that, but I wonder if you have a thought on that subject.
We tried in the guidelines to provide some text to say how the interactions between the science program and the Independent Science Board and how the interactions between the Independent Science Board and the Council would act. But certainly, if there are other aspects of other interactions that they might have with other entities, we could certainly try to bring that in. I think right now we have a section on their interactions with the lead scientist, interactions with the Delta Science Program staff, interactions with other boards and panels, things of that type are in the guidelines, and that's where we try to capture that sense.
Okay. I did note under the Delta Reform Act, I think paragraph C is not quite a correct statement of the law, but it's not. We can figure that out in the next draft. And I want to make sure that the memo talks about the role of the Science Board in particular and with some clarity in its relationship to our roles as a responsible agency and the separate role of a potential appellate body regarding BDCP. That's very important. I think we've got to clarify that, and I think it would be useful to do so in this document. And then, although I suspect it's the next document, I know I'd talk to you about it, Mr. Dom. I like the idea of a statement of clarity that the Independent Science Board is independent and what that means. And I know the conflict of interest is addressing issues of economic interest and so on and so forth, which is fine, but I did not see anywhere in here a declaration that we want the independent judgments of the Science Board, not just to call them independent. And maybe I missed it, but I found the more precise conflict of interest language, but I didn't find any policy statement in under either Attachment B or the rest of the stuff that would do that. You know, I'm going to just raise the questions I've gotten. You know, you can think about them.
Yeah, I believe there is some text. And I'm just looking quickly to see whether it's in the charge or whether it's in the guidelines. But basically, we did try to incorporate some text about the independence and best professional judgment of the scientists on the Independent Science Board, much like you had requested in our last meeting. I'm not finding it immediately, but I'll make sure that it's
if you would, I'd appreciate
inculcated into both documents.
On the Attachment 2, which is the, what in the dickens do you call it, the operating guidelines under reporting relationship, the Independent Science Board reports to the council and works closely with the lead scientist. Maybe I misunderstood it, but I thought the Independent Board works with the lead scientist and collectively they report to the council, to the Stewardship Council. Do I have that wrong?
At least the organization chart I've seen has them reporting directly to you.
Just my suggestion, Mr. Coolidge, is you and Cliff and Joe work on that. I just want to make sure that's clearly understood. I think it's easy to solve. On page 5 of the operating guidelines, amendments, these operating guidelines may be amended based on a consensus of ISB members. I love the idea of consensus. What does it mean? It doesn't define itself, and if you want to, it seems to me if you've got a set of rules and you want to change them, you ought to more clearly state what the changes would be. Then on the conflict of interest provisions on page 11, this is not really to you. This is probably to Mr. Stevens. The Open Meeting Act prohibits a group of scientists retained for their independent science judgment from communicating with each other about science. I mean, that's got to be really dumb. Maybe still legal. I understand that.
I'm glad you qualified it with that last part.
Thank you. I mean, scientific collaboration, I mean, the essence of it, the best of it is a free and untrammeled exchange of ideas and yelling and screaming and hollering at each other. And this seems to suggest that it almost be one of those ponderous, let's do everything at meetings, not talk to, I mean.
You know, we've debated this philosophical / legal question for a few years now, as Cliff and other scientists are aware. And in fact, we had tried with the legislature to get a clear exemption for the science board and other science panels from the draconian restrictions of the state open meetings law. But since they're required to be set up in statute, unfortunately, they do fall within the bounds of that law. But I don't disagree with, from a policy standpoint, that that's an avenue that we might want to pursue again. However, I do note that we did try that once, and there was the flip side of the argument is that these are important issues that should be debated in public and everybody should be aware, and this should be a transparent process. So two sides to the issue.
I mean, we certainly would have preferred to have a situation where
I think I think Mr. Stevens said we're stuck. That's what I is that a summary of your statement?
You told me to define the problem first and then to try to think.
Nice shot. Mr. Natoli, then Mr. Nordhoff.
Chris, then is it the when you talk about Bagley-Keene that you can't have more than two scientists discuss issues, and then if they were discussed with the third or the fourth?
It'd be the same multi-member body, you know, whatever your, if you have 10, then it would be a quorum of six. And so the same issues, and it really is impractical. I mean, from my, this is editorializing, obviously. And it may be worthwhile that we pursue, a legislative exemption. We've tried it in the past. It's not a new issue. All the scientists are well aware of it.
Well, again, I could even understand if you had a quorum of them, if you had, six or more that came together, it's one thing. But for, say three of them, then that becomes a committee structure that has to, to sit down and talk about a issue that they're going to be bringing forward to this body or, working on, that becomes very inhibitive as it relates to certainly some of the work that you would ask them to do. So, okay. Thanks.
Mr. Nordhoff. Okay. Take a look at that, if you would, please, and let's get back to it. On page 13, avoidance of conflicts. I've read this three times, and I'm still not quite sure I understand what it's about. In order to minimize or avoid conflicts of interest, the Delta Independent Science Board, as a body, will not be asked to provide advice to the council or the Delta Science Program on specific elements within any request for proposals. Now, is this projects that are requesting the Science Board to be funded?
I'm going to ask Chris to because this is something that came out of some text that we had from our previous Independent Science Board, and I really did not also understand the context for this.
Oh, okay.
Oh, good. Well,
that's a good answer. I was going to defer to Lauren because what I think that it relates to is the involvement of the Independent Science Board in individual grant proposals. What we had tried to do was to separate and make sure that the Independent Science Board took a broad overview of issues and didn't get into the weeds on which projects to fund. And that had to do with the affiliations of the members of the board universities.
But you've got rules in here that say if there's a financial interest, direct or indirect, they're supposed to exclude themselves.
But from a practical standpoint, at least in my experience, it became very inhibitive in terms of the time spent on conflict checks when the Independent Science Board was actually weighing in on individual grant proposals. It consumed all of the board's time when they should have been focusing in on the big issues. And I think, at least from a policy standpoint, in the previous CalFed Independent Science Board, we had decided that it would just be more practical to put something like this in place. Well, given that we still have state law that you have to follow anyway, this seemed like the way, and I think that it worked well. I mean, Lauren can address it. Do you have anything to add?
And I also realize, just looking at this again, it might make sense to combine that section with the next one on peer review, because I believe it is relating to our proposal process and peer review. But we can clarify this.
Yeah, I mean, I think all of the stuff ought to get a substantial rewrite and edit on the whole thing. And I had the same kind of question on peer review, because under avoidance of conflicts, you say they can give advice on peer review processes in general. I have no idea what that means. But anyway, I think we work out the language. Then just the last thing, and Mr. Tom, I just want to flag this for an issue. I believe that the Independent Science Board somewhere, and hopefully in the charge, would recommend to us a preliminary definition for the best available science or the best available scientific information, which are our foundations of our duties, exercising our duties according to the statute. You know, we're to apply best available science. And I thought also in response to some of the questions earlier, there was some concern from the science folks about trying to do that. And if there is a concern, I want to schedule a particular time where we talk about it. I'm not asking you to say right now what's the best available science on everything, but I at least like to know when everybody says best available science, there must be a process to reach a point where the real experts, the scientists, say, yeah, that seems to be it. And that process, in my judgment, ought to be part of our procedures.
Yeah, I think getting the process on paper would be probably better than just a formal definition. How do you go about defining what you see?
Yeah, but you're going to have to put the elements in there. I mean, whether it's, I assume best available science is one that has some level of peer review. I mean, I don't know that, but maybe that's it. Maybe it's science that has been subject to examination for a certain period of time. I don't know that, but it might. I mean, those kinds of things give people some level of certainty about what's going to be involved. I don't want to get in the classic case of, who was it, Judge Stewart, and defining obscenity according to the rulings of the U.S. Supreme Court. I can't tell you what it is, but I know it when I see it. That seems to me to be not the right way to proceed. So just flag that as an issue, and when we come back, if we could address that.
And you'd like to see that in the charge, correct?
I think it logically, to me, would be a good place. We thought about originally putting a definition in the interim plan. We know we're going to have comparable questions in the Delta plan, which is coming up soon. I'm agnostic as to where, but it seems to me we ought to have the scientists give a shot at telling us kind of what it looks like.
We currently have a draft definition in the interim plan, and I believe what we were planning to do is have our ISB review and comment on that.
And I am open. I am
open
to
a
process.
We definitely want them to weigh in on it.
But we're going to need that sooner than later. Okay, Mr. Nordhoff.
I don't know. I think we're getting our knickers in knots about stuff that will stand in the way of a free exchange on science. I mean, who knows what the best available science is at any time? It's a matter of, it's subjective, it's a matter of opinion, it's a matter of demonstration. And I think maybe we're leading, instead of having 10 scientists, why don't we throw 5 scientists and 5 lawyers to make sure we don't make any mistakes?
No. The reason why this is important and the reason why that phrase, best available science, has now started to creep into the water laws is because when people are fighting about contentious proposals, the folks who think they might not win the fight always ask for more additional scientific studies to go beyond it. And the legislature has started in a whole bunch of areas to begin using that, saying there has to be a point at which you say, not what's the perfect science, one that will last for 1,000 years, but what is sufficient and sufficiently substantive scientific information upon which you can act, and more importantly, upon which you can rely when you face legal challenges against the action. Mm. So I understand it sounds like it is too constraining. It is too constraining. But this is a subject area which will be, Mr. Stevens' preferences notwithstanding, extensively litigated.
Yeah, I guess from a layman's standpoint, for me it's important to have the best scientists around and that they be independent. I think that's a critical word, mm-hmm. that there not be any conflicts here which they could be attacked. And that should all be screened in advance, making sure they don't have any relationships that could throw their independence into question.
And I think we have assembled a group of independent, top-notch scientists.
I think you have.
Yeah. Okay.
Then let them be scientists and not lawyers.
Okay. Sounds like good advice to me.
One thing that might be useful is if you can crank out another draft that we could post at or near our August meeting, even if we don't have a hearing on it, it might be useful to get the next draft out to let people take a look at it in advance and then have the comments and discussions.
Yeah, I think we'd like to see this be an iterative process, and we'd like to get your feedback on this first shot at a draft and guidelines.
Okay, good. Thank you. Okay, any other questions, members? Okay, thank you very much. No action, I'm sorry. All right, anyone in the audience like to speak on this, or do you want to reserve it for the next hearing where you have the draft in front of you, the alternative draft? Okay, seeing no one, let's pass on. Supervisor Natoli, you're going to kick this file item 8 off for us, I believe.
Okay. Well, thank you, Chair Eisenberg. And in just a moment, you're going to hear from some of my colleagues from the Delta counties. They wear multiple hats as well. And I would just like to be certainly first amongst folks here to thank certainly the Sugar Mill for hosting today's and tomorrow's meeting for this session. It was nice to see the welcoming sign as we came in, welcoming the Stewardship Council and certainly all the folks that are here in attendance. And I don't know the specific order, but as they've come forward, we're going to hear from First, from Mike McGowan, supervisor at Yolo County, member of the Delta Protection Commission, and we're in his supervisorial district here in Yolo County. We'll also hear from Vice Chair and Solano County Supervisor, Vice Chair of the Delta Protection Commission, Mike Reagan, Solano County Supervisor. You also hear from Supervisor Larry Rustaller, member of the Delta Protection Commission, San Joaquin County Supervisor, who has been heading up the effort with the commission relative to the primary zone review as well as economic sustainability. And then we'll hear from Yolo County Supervisor Jim Provenza, who is a member of the Delta Conservancy, and unfortunately our member from the Delta Protection Commission, Mary Pifo, was not able to join us, but Jim will give us a very good overview. But you have four very dedicated local officials here, members of respective staffs that help both the Delta County's coalition, the supervisors, and others in their role. And in my role as chair of the Delta Protection Commission, I sit on this panel, and so that'd be a bit awkward if I was to jump over there and give a presentation to you all. So these folks, on behalf of the commission, respective local government representatives and others, will, I think, give you a good overview of what we have been working on at the local level, certainly at the commission level, the conservancy level, and feel free, certainly as a panel, but also members of the audience, as they conclude their presentations, to ask questions and get more information, because I think you're going to hear about a lot of good work that's going on. And with that, Chair Eisenberg, I think Mr. McGowan was going to head it up. So
I think Supervisor Reagan starts it. He's also the official timekeeper, meaning he is duty-bound to control his soft-spoken and mild-mannered colleagues at all things. Is that correct? By the way, ladies and gentlemen, I should say, somebody found a set of keys to ostensibly three or four vehicles, pliers, and other things.
It's a sound technician.
Oh, this is from our sound technicians? Oh. Hmm.
It slices and dices and makes power.
Here, you come forward and get your keys. Yeah, thank you.
But wait, there's more.
So, gentlemen?
Yeah, I think I'll go first, and at the risk of offending any fellow attorneys, I can't help but tell this quick story about the two guys that took off in an hot air balloon and get lost in the fog, and they break out over the nice meadow, and they look down, and here's Chris Stevens standing there in the field, and one balloonist yells down to him and says, "Where are we?" And Chris looks up and says, "You're in a balloon." So one balloonist turns to the other and says, "That guy's an attorney." "Well, how do you know?" "Well, because what he told us was absolutely correct, but totally useless." Well, and with that, welcome, Councilmember Johnston. So glad that you could join us today. I know you were saving yourself for the most important part of my speech. So,
nor is he offended by your comments about.
No, he's the one that told it to me. Actually, it's his joke. Welcome to the Delta. I can't say how happy we are. We are very happy that you're here. In our midst. And I know you had a great tour and you saw certain parts of it, and I hope that was educational to you all on the specifics you were looking at, but I hope it also gave you an indication of really how diverse the Delta is and how the myriad of the issues are that we're all dealing with. For those of us who represent local government, primarily the five Delta counties, a couple of things we've struggled with is, one, finding and then establishing our voice for representation. But the other part has been making the point that, the Delta is a very complex and dynamic place. And sometimes it's referred to as this monolithic organism that really doesn't have shades and nuances and complexities. And in fact, it does, and I hope that you saw that. I hope you also saw the sign outside when you came in. If not, please take a look at it. You're here in District 1 in Yolo County. This is a district that I have the pleasure of representing along with the town or the city of West Sacramento. We are very proud of our community here in Clarksburg. The sign will tell you the extremely large, although we have a relatively small number of people living down here, about 1,500 population for the entire Clarksburg district. It should be very impressive to you, the large number of families who have lived here for many, many generations. I was looking at the sign myself and even surprised to see that, as an example, the Serpa family goes back 8 generations, many of them 3, 4, 5, 6 generations of families, and they're still here generation after generation and working in their community to help it and improve it. And here in Clarksburg is an example. We have schools for that relatively small number of people. We have schools that go through K through 8, including a charter school for elementary school. We have two churches. We probably crank out more Eagle Scouts out of the Clarksburg area than any other per capita than any other community in the United States of America, as many as 2 to 3 to 4 kids, young men, are elevated to the status of Eagle Scout almost every year here in Clarksburg. It is a great tribute to the people here and the community that they've founded, and that they have developed, and that they protect. And they are only an example, one example, of the different communities that are up and down the. This wonderful delta that we have. Our message in welcoming you is, again, to thank you to be here, thank you for being here, and I guess to impress upon you our sincere desire to work collaboratively with you, with the council, so that your work will be successful in the implementation of whatever plan you come up with, and that we will be successful here at the local level in continuing to be able to represent our constituents who elected us to do the best we can for them. You know, I've had a number of conversations with Phil, and I don't know that I've ever shared this with him publicly, certainly. I don't think I've even mentioned it privately. But, you know, we're the place, as he mentioned to me back in about 1971 when he was a guest speaker at my government class at State College, and he was a council member. He impressed me with this observation, and that is local government is the place where the rubber meets the road. Now, it's really the place where service meets demand. It's also the place where probably the greatest level of transparency and accountability reside in all of our governments. And it's a place where we take our charge very seriously, as I know you do as well. So we're from the local governments. We're here to help you. We're to help you to succeed. And we hope in return you'll see us as the resource, as a real tool to allow you to develop a plan that will be relevant not just the purposes of the state policy that you're putting together, but relevant and appropriate for the people who do live here. And with that, I will say on behalf of the 5 counties who represent the Delta, Yolo, Sacramento, Solano, San Joaquin, and Contra Costa, we thank you for your public service. We thank you for your time. We look forward to continuing to be able to work with each and every one of you for a real positive and constructive plan that will benefit the entire state of California. And lastly, I do really appreciate the fact, and I mean this in all sincerity, that on the bottom of your agenda, you talk about the co-equal goals, and you do add the clause. The co-equal goals shall be achieved in a manner that protects and enhances the unique cultural, recreational, natural resource, and agricultural values of the Delta as an evolving place. We are the Delta. We are that evolving place. Thank you for recognizing that, and we look forward to working with you.
Thank you. Supervisor.
Thank you. I guess I need to have the clicker for that timer over there. No.
30 seconds.
Anyhow, again, thank you. I'm glad to have the opportunity to brief you a little bit about some of the work product that the Delta Protection Commission has embarked on, much of which that you'll see in other areas. And I'll go through some of them, and I'll have Supervisor Ruestaller and Supervisor McGowan cover 2 of the other work products that you've helped to fund as we go through this. Starting out with the Land Use and Resource Management Plan for the primary zone of the Delta. At our mandate in the Delta Protection Act that Senator Johnston had a little bit to do with, was initially done in 1992, and we did an update that has been adopted in February of this year. And these policies provide guidance to the Delta Protection Commission on the implementation of our authorities in state legislation. And in your role as an appellant to development proposals, you should know that we do not have any current hearings scheduled for development in the Delta. The plan was amended with the new legislation in mind, and adopted taking the Delta Plan process into consideration, and we would highly recommend that this Delta Land Use and Resource Management Plan for the primary zone be utilized as part of your interim Delta Plan and considered as a basis of development for your final Delta Plan. It's extant, it's updated, it's current, and it covers much of what will have to be part of management of the Delta going forward. The second work product is the National Heritage Area Feasibility Study. That was a mandate to the Commission under SBX 7-1 to complete a feasibility study for establishment of the Delta National Heritage Area. That time frame did not give us a explicit time frame, but of course, as you're all aware, Senator Feinstein has proposed draft legislation that has got us all scrambling. We have a consulting team under contract. They have started doing public hearings in the Delta together to educate people what a National Heritage Area is and to gather input. Partial funding was secured from the National Historic Preservation Trust, and those workshops and interviews are underway, and we think that that public input is extremely important to the process and required to successfully apply for status from the National Park Service. A third project that I'd like to talk about is the Great California Delta Trail. That mandate was in SB 1556 to the Commission to complete a feasibility study and a blueprint for what is known as the Great California Delta Trail System. We had 2 years from receiving the funding to the completion, and of course, given the state's budget, we have only received partial funding to date.
What's your deadline likely to be on the trail study?
I think we'll probably have at least another year and a half. We've accomplished much of the work in Contra Costa and Solano County, and the funding has to be provided to get into the other three. And so that'll be, the clock will depend on when the cash arrives. We have a contractor under contract for Solano and Contra Costa, and the framework is there for the eventual extension in the other three counties. Funding process in Solano and Contra Costa, we actually got additional monies from the Coastal Conservancy grant, a Solano County grant, and a Contra Costa County general fund contribution to help with the process in those two counties. There is a technical and stakeholder advisory committees formed and guiding the process, and workshops have been facilitated, and there are more this month and next month. And the blueprint from those two counties will be completed in September. Two links with existing trails have been established within Solano County with the Bay Area Trail. So, I mean, we're taking those things into consideration. The Lower Yolo Bypass Planning Form is another work product of the Delta Protection Commission. It was a formed partnership between the Delta Protection Commission and the Yolo Basin Foundation. It's funded by Prop 50, Fish and Game, and CalFed. The intent is to create a management plan for the Lower Yolo Bypass. The plan will consider flood control, habitat, and agricultural aspects of the bypass, and they've been trying to inform the BDCP process as well. And the success of the bypass management to date should serve as a model for your Delta Plan programs to try to achieve the co-equal zones. We have a successful model in being that I think serves as a good model for you. Another product of the DPC is the Working Landscapes Program. That was formed a partnership developed between the DPC and the Ducks Unlimited and Heart Restoration to promote habitat-friendly ag practices within the Delta. That also was funded by a Prop 50 Fish and Game and CalFed grant. It was initiated in March of 2010. It's a three-year program, and it is both wetland and riparian demonstration projects that will be implemented with willing landowners. And there's been significant interest to participate. that we've seen. Another project that is we are a part of is the long-term management strategy for dredging for the Delta. That was formed by the Army Corps of Engineers with every relevant entity to develop a strategy for reuse of dredged material generated within the Delta. DPC serves on the executive committee. I'm their representative on that. And Linda Fiak, our executive director, has represented us on the management committee. That is vital. This program is absolutely vital to enhance both the dredging and the levee maintenance within the Delta. Another product that we'd like to make you aware of is the Delta Emergency Response Strategy. The team was formed pursuant to SB 27 to develop a Delta-wide strategy for emergency management and response. The team is facilitated by the California Emergency Management Agency. DWR and the Delta County emergency managers are also on the team. The strategy development is near completion. We've been working on this for a couple years now. And will be tested in an exercise in the Delta in the near future. Funding is always an issue. My peers here will be discussing the primary zone study recommendation to the legislature and the economic sustainability plan. Before I turn that over to them, I'd like to make a few comments about levee repair and its importance to the flood management in California and the importance of dredging to the Delta. Levee repair, you know, when people think of natural disasters in California, they typically think of earthquakes. Yet the natural disaster residents are most likely to face involves flooding, not fault lines. You may be surprised learning that all 58 counties in the state have declared a flood-related state of emergency at least three times since 1950. The California Emergency Management Agency reports that about 15% of the state's total population lives in a flood insurance rate map designated floodplain. Most of this population resides in urban centers located in floodplains where flooding could result in extensive loss of life and billions of dollars worth of damage. The potential direct flood damages in the Sacramento area alone could exceed $25 billion. Some areas of the Central Valley could experience flood depths of 20 feet or more if levees fail. Sacramento-San Joaquin River Delta and the San Francisco Bay Estuary beyond providing drinking water to approximately 22, 23 million Californians, supports important economic activities, including commercial and sport fishing, shipping, agriculture, recreation, tourism, natural gas extraction and transmission, and many other industries. Evidence has shown that the ground subsidence and lack of ongoing maintenance on our levee systems could threaten all of these vital components of California. To ensure the integrity of the flood management system, there is a need for immediate and ongoing Delta levee repair and rehabilitation. The lack of same reduces levee stability, threatens water quality, and puts our community's critical state infrastructure and natural resources at risk. An isolated water conveyance will not reduce the need to maintain the displacement provided by Delta Islands and their effect on the fresh water flow going from the Delta into the bay that you just mentioned the State Water Board is working on. Even if a canal or tunnel proposed by the BDCB is approved, it'll be over a decade before it's operational. It's imperative that the Delta's levees be maintained. The Delta Counties Coalition encourages the Delta Stewardship Council to consider the following flood protection principles to preserve and protect the integrity of the Delta in your plan. One, the first is obviously to help resolve the state's dichotomous role as both a regulator and a project proponent. Not only being the operator of the state water project, but it's also responsible for the federal project levies, has been reaffirmed by the Paterno decision, and much more. Both intra-agency and inter-agency conflict exists at the state level, and resolving that should, I think, be a task that you guys try to address. Second, I would recommend that you set a clear objective to preserve, rehabilitate, and to the extent necessary, improve all 1,100 miles of project and non-project levee system in the Delta. And recognize and support that this levee system is an integrated engineering work, and it's codependent, and it exists throughout the Delta. So, basically, if you have a sole focus on the federal project levees and the other levees fail, you will have the salinity intrusion in that will decimate the both the water supply, export mission, and the ecosystem within the Delta. And we would recommend that you recognize that different levels of flood protection and levee structural integrity are appropriate for different land uses. The major urban areas need one level of protection, the legacy communities another, and agricultural levees a third. And that different level of flood protection is sometimes difficult to get through the bureaucracy, as they tend to try to have a one solution fits all mindset. We would recommend that you develop and implement integrated flood planning, response, and recovery programs with appropriate partnerships, funding streams, and regulatory reform to ensure appropriate and coordinated emergency response. We've got people working on the initial plans there, but I think that's a work that is obviously in your charge as well. Develop sustainable and broad-based funding mechanisms to support flood protection activities within the Delta, and preserve the Delta Levee Maintenance Program from the California Water Code, and I've got the sites here if you need them. The state subventions program, it must be funded at higher levels with a multi-year funding commitment we need to get a process improvement for expediting reimbursement. Voter approval of funding exists to accomplish this through release of Prop 84 and 1E funds. We would recommend that you develop state and local general fund and specialized sources of funding for flood protection, preserve and maximize federal investment. CalFed Levy Stability Improvement Program is an avenue for federal financial aid for levy rehabilitation projects. Active ongoing support of this core project legislatively is requested. The Corps has a Delta-wide list of projects and has begun implemented the first few projects this year. Active advocacy for continued funding of this project at the federal level is important. And again, avoid the one-size-fits-all approaches by adopting standards and funding for O&M that allows the local managers an opportunity to prioritize the use of funds based on their expertise and knowledge of the deficiencies that create the greatest risks. Don't design it from on high, absent the input of the people that can ground truth reality for you. And that recognize that there are multiple benefits provided by flood control facilities and activities in the Delta, including recognition that flood protection infrastructure is necessary to achieve many other societal zone goals, such as transportation, environmental restoration, water supply, health, and local economic activity. Lastly, in relation to the levee's ongoing pre-placement of emergency rock stockpiles for levee repair is vital. Where stockpiles exist to block waterways, there are no corresponding piles for levee breaches, and there should be. This is important because if a levee break occurs, prompt repair of the breach with available materials may prevent a larger scale problem from occurring, the domino scenario that you've seen being an example. And then lastly, I'd like to talk a little bit about dredging and how important and necessary excavation activity is to maintain navigable waterway depths for the safe and convenient navigation of ships. We do have two international ports within the Delta. In the navigation channels and at berthing and mooring facilities, including marinas within the Delta. The Delta long-term management strategy that the Corps is leading is composed of federal, state, and local agencies working together to streamline permitting for dredging and reuse of sediments on levees and in wetland restorations. Meaningful support of this process by the Stewardship Council, DWR, and other state agencies will help expedite the wide-scale reuse of dredged material placement on levees. Hint, the Central Valley Flood Water Quality Management people need to be brought on board a little bit. Your active advocacy to obtain continued federal funding for this program is important. The current, I also serve on the BCDC in the Bay Area, where we are already noticing that the one of the reasons that the Delta levees are so close to the waterways was to hydraulically flush out much of the sediment that was created with the gold mining, hydrologic mining. It's been successful. That slug of material has passed through the Golden Gate, and now as the Bay Area is trying to restore salt marshes, and they breach levees and they expect sediment to be deposited, they are now talking about sediment deficits. We need to have very clear and distinct plans for how we're going to use the sediment generated within the Delta, that are generated in the Delta within the Delta. And we want to probably try to avoid importing it from outside sources because of the invasive species problems that occur there. So that's a major emphasis area that, again, needs to be part of your work program. And with that, I'll turn it, I'll shut up and get back to my timekeeping.
Okay.
And Supervisor Rustaller, I think, was going to talk about the primary zone recommendation.
Thank you. Supervisor.
Thank you. Did you keep your own time?
No, I was talking.
Thank you very much.
I don't know if it's on.
It looks like it's on, but I think you have to pull it closer to you than you might.
How about this? Is it on yet?
Yes, it is on.
I'm on? Okay. I'd hate for you to miss this for the permanent record. As you know, Senate Bill X71 directed the Delta Protection Commission to prepare and submit to the legislature recommendations regarding the potential expansion of or change to the primary zone of or the Delta. We think that probably should have been not an or, but a of the Delta, but since that's the way the law was written, that's the way it is. It basically mentioned six areas: Rio Vista, Eielton, Bethel Island, Brannan and Andrus Island, the Cosumnes and McCollumy River floodways, and the San Joaquin South Delta lowlands. If any of you can find that South Delta lowlands for us, that would help us a lot on that particular area. Based on this directive, the Delta Protection Commission instituted a process in early February of 2010 to complete the primary zone study. It was due July 1st, and that's kind of an important, as you can see, we had a very short timeline, and as I will explain, we also had no money. The February 10th, 2010, the Delta Protection Commission established the primary zone study committee, consisting of seven members of the Delta Protection Commission, which represented not only in Delta people, elected people, and state people. The first committee meeting was held in March. The committee has met four times since, and we continue to meet every month. Despite several severe funding challenges, which you stepped in and helped with, the committee was able to release a request for proposal, interview a consulting firm, and hire in April of 2010. Unfortunately, all of the state paperwork didn't get quite finished until July this month. Our consultant worked on, quote, good faith and our promise that it would be done, and so we were able to accomplish a great deal. The committee has directed the consultant and achieved significant milestones. The committee and the consultant have developed a conceptual framework for completion of the study and have developed the key assessment and ranking criteria. The boundaries for the studies have been preliminarily delineated and will be presented to the full Delta Protection Commission next week at its meeting. The first steps in the public outreach component of the study have been completed, which consisted of two community workshops held in the Delta, plus interviewing local government representatives, community groups, private individuals within the primary zone study. Input from the public outreach efforts is being used to refine and set the parameters for this further study. Extensive data available regarding Delta resources and issues is being compiled for the six designated study areas, and the consulting team is developing a ranking matrix that will be used to refine that study. Key issues raised during the community workshops is needed to gather additional public input and reach out to the communities potentially affected by this study. Therefore, the committee and the consultant team are developing a broader public outreach effort in order to ensure all interested parties have an opportunity to participate. In order to ensure the public outreach efforts are effective and the study is thorough and defensible, the committee and the consulting team are anticipating the continued preparation of this study and development of the resulting recommendations beyond the July 1st deadline. In closing, let me note that while the results of the Delta Protection Commission's efforts in the studying the primary zone are important steps in informing the council and the legislature, the process by which the public is included in this study is even more important. Unless we have the confidence of the people in the Delta that we are engaging them in this study, that they are truly listening, we are truly listening to their concerns and opinions, and that we are working in collaboration with them in shaping the Delta, our efforts will not be successful. As with our effort to engage the public, we urge the council to do the same with respect to the Delta plan. To us, the Delta Protection Commission, it is better to take the time to get it right, to engage in the messy business of democracy, to come to conclusions based on fact and science, not politics. We remain confident that the council shares our view about this process. As we have said in the past to the legislatures and others, we get it. We understand our role under the recently passed legislation. We are committed to working with all parties who share our interests and values with respect to the Delta and the people who live and work there. Working in good faith together, we can get the job done. Rather than impose solutions on the people of the Delta, engage us openly in this first instance in fashioning the solutions to the problems we all see in the Delta, and we guarantee that we will be able to show good results. We would hope to get this plan not only to the legislature but to you so that you'll be able to use this for your Delta plan. We want all of this information that's being gathered to come up and actually be of use, not just be another on the shelf.
Do you have a sense of when? I understand the problems.
We're hoping by this fall.
Do you know when?
I can't. We'll know more when the consultant presents his final or his ongoing report to us next Thursday, and we will then get that to you as quickly as he gives it that to us, and the full commission is able to hear what we've heard as a committee. When the full commission hears this, we will then get that up to you. But we know that if it's no good if it gets to you, a day after you've written your plan. And we know you're moving very quickly, and we hope that our small part in this information will be able to get to you.
Mr. Chair, if I might just, we intend to, I think, Larry, correct me if I'm wrong, is to, after the commission receives a report next Thursday evening, as I believe, to put together a status letter, certainly to send to the legislature as well as to the council to let it, to answer a portion of your question about what the timing would be, but also to lay out what the process would be going forward. And the idea, I think, as Larry has represented on behalf of the commission, is to do the groundwork that needs to be done, recognizing that obviously it called out in the legislation for July 1st. We will provide an update before months end via a status letter, and I think outline for this council, for the legislature, and for the public what the plan is over the course of the next 2 to 3 months to continue with that work, and hopefully have, as I think Larry pointed out, an opportunity to inform this body's work relative to the Delta plan itself with the primary zone information and study, as well as obviously the work product that will be produced as a part of that work. So is that correct, Larry?
No, you're correct. Okay.
Mr. Johnston.
At our last meeting, Don, we discussed having the council engage the Delta Protection Commission on discussing and resolving any differences in the resource management plan, which is a very constructive document and helpful, I think, to our work. But where there are concerns by state agencies or others, talking about those early on, I think, would be good. And perhaps also, as you do your work at the Delta Protection Commission to recommend to the legislature, this council could have a process to meet and discuss with you your recommendations as they unfold. Because as a practical matter, the legislature will return in December, but really in January. And I would think that would be the time that they would consider whatever recommendations you would have. And prior to that time, I think it would be helpful for the council to meet and discuss with you and perhaps reach some agreement on what those recommendations might be.
Speaking for me, but I think on behalf of the DPC, I think that would be a welcome process, and we would embrace that if we get a chance to work on it, absolutely.
Mr. Chairman, any thoughts about that? You would like, obviously, you have representatives from the commission here, and again, I will just say we have, as Larry pointed out, of the state agencies and other representatives on the commission are part of that subcommittee that's been working on the effort. Would you think that should occur at the staff level, Pat, or would you like intervening report with some general outline, and we could see where there might be some areas of concern, and then direct our respective staffs and consultants to work on that? I guess I didn't. How did you envision maybe trying to resolve what might be any particular issues?
Well, certainly it's helpful if staffs talk, but I was thinking perhaps that our chair, that Phil, might talk to you, the chair of DPC, and figure out where a couple of members of each body would talk, not just staff.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
And I think that interaction goes a long way towards clearing up a bunch of clutter that we otherwise are going to find ourselves encumbered with if we're not talking and communicating.
One of the things that interests me, and hopefully it's going to come out of the plan you've adopted and the two to come, the final economic sustainability and this Delta plan, but I want to make sure that, for example, we know what you are recommending and the five counties individually are agreeing to on population density. The resource management plan has a comment about that, but you know, if that's the policy, which is as best I can understand the resource management plan, it is whatever was legally permitted on density in 1992 when your law went into effect is the maximum. That's the way I read it. May not be, but that's the way I read it. If that's the consistent thing that's applying to all three plans, it sure helps us because we have to actually make it a consistency determination on the economic sustainability plan under the law. We consider and review the primary zone, and we've already agreed to consider and review resource management. I'm confusing the plans. But, I mean, consistent definitions and major articulations of what your positions are helps also.
Well, I think this phenomenon you're talking about is where really both the world could get challenging, but also I think it could get fun. Because we're in the Delta Protection Commission right now is guided primarily by the rules of engagement with the Delta Protection Act, and our Delta Protection Resource Management Plan must...
The 1992 enactment.
Right. Yeah. We must comply with, and we went through a lot of process in our Resource Management Plan with lots of involvement, lots of engagement, lots of interesting conversations about it. We came up with a plan, Resource Management Plan, that we believe kept faith with the original Act. Now, reconciling that with what your perception of a plan should be for the Delta and what we, say the counties think economic sustainability needs, and whatever overlay the primary study gets, I'm not sure we could say today exactly where that all winds up, because there's going to need to be a reconciliation. Candidly, my belief is that that ultimate reconciliation authority comes from you. But we're hoping that through our work, we can get to a point where it's acceptable, it's seamless, and it's actually informative as to what the ultimate Delta plan looks like. And our resource management plan and our economic sustainability plan have to conform to your plan. We're hoping that gets to be just a semantical argument that, in fact, they reconcile each other because we're landing at the same place. I mean, that would be, to me, a good policy a good public principle to try to achieve. So I don't know what that is. I don't know what that looks like right now. But to me, personally, having been on this Delta Protection Commission since day one, when Patrick talked me into doing it, it seems
you've been
to me
mad
like
at him ever since, right?
That would be not at all. That would be the definition of success for me.
Okay. Great. Thank you, Supervisor. Appreciate it.
And it'll be brief. Economic sustainability, actually, I'll give you the DPC's version, which is we're, as you know, been mandated to complete the project by next year. We have formed a committee to work on that. We are retaining the services, I think, of the Bay Area Economics Consulting Team to do the work. I believe money's and checks in the mail or money's in the bank. Thank you very much. You guys have been very positive in that regard. We, as I said, just mentioned, we're hoping that this is as much of an informative process for your plan as it is anything else. I don't want to go into much more detail about that. I'd like to emphasize an economic sustainability plan is the blueprint or the outline or whatever you want to call it that allows the folks in the Delta, in my opinion, to have profitable and constructive and meaningful lives and businesses that are in sync with the bigger state policy that we talked about in the co-equal goals. You are in the middle of a very successful model for economic sustainability, both in this building, which is a converted sugar beet factory, now winery and event center and wine tasting place. It's a home, for instance, of the Herringer vineyards. This is one of those six, I think, soon to be seventh generations families. The young son comes back from Fresno with his degree in winemaking and tells the father, Mr. Steve Herringer, who's of my generation, that just having yield on the acreage for grapes is not the secret. The secret is in the quality, not the quantity. Tells his dad he's got to cut about a third of the grapes off of the vine and throw them on the ground. And after Steve Herringer has a heart attack and realizes that that's actually a way to make better wine, off they go. So that is our future here in this area. Economic sustainability for us is a continued awareness of that dynamic and appreciation of that industry and support of the industry in a way that allows it to be meaningful. A couple of things that are, I think, for all of us in the Delta that are the most challenging, really the most challenging, I think, at this point is the level of uncertainty that we're living with as to what the afterlife will be. The FEMA maps themselves have been a huge, the FEMA designations have been a very huge negative a factor in our economic sustainability hopes because it leaves us in a place of not only not being able to do any sort of residential construction and be challenged by those kinds of buildings or renovations, but even more importantly, it makes it very uncertain as to what kind of commercial and industrial growth we can have. So it's a huge factor. And the other one is, as I suggest, it is the uncertainty. Economic sustainability and a successful economic sustainability package allows for and encourages people to invest money into a commercial activity, an industrial activity. And so we need to get to the point where the rules of the game are clear so that folks like the Herringers or the Bogles, just built a new winery, I think it has a 2 million case capacity. They're about the eighth largest winery in the country, and they're another multi-generational family here in Clarksburg. So it's our future down here. So the Delta Protection Commission is I think, dedicated to coming up with this plan. Our position is it needs to be informative to your work. It needs to be in sync with the final plan of the Delta through the Stewardship Council, and we want it to be one that works. Finally, I'll just say the last two things. One of my frustrations in a lot of the discussion over the legislation last year was the apparent lack of recognition that it's the counties that are really the best suited. Once the rules of the game are established, we're the best suited to do the to actually do the development and the implementation of those kind of plans through land use, economic development, things of that nature. We're also the people that are responsible for the things that go along with that, such as housing, the basic sewer water infrastructure, roads, and things of that nature. We're the ones that are responsible for that. We're also the ones who know how to do it and really the most effective way to meet the goal. And so whatever we have, whatever we wind up with, needs to be a workable tool that the counties can then go back and say, okay, I can make this work. I get what everybody else wants to do with the water and the environment here in the Delta, but I see a plan that can be successful for our needs so we can continue to have the kind of viability in a community like Clarksburg that we presently have and perhaps even build on that. And lastly, I'll say, for the fundamental advance of economic sustainability, a practical thing you could do is, before you leave tonight, you could buy some wine that was grapes of which are grown here in the Clarksburg area and were bottled right here in this building. And Mr. Herringer will open up his tasting room for you at the conclusion of this meeting, and he'll keep it open for as long as you wish to sample the fruits of this wonderful District 1 of Yolo County. Thank you very much.
But
Amen.
Not after 2 a.m.
Oh, well, certainly, but we do roll the clocks back here.
And with that, I think I turn it over to you for
no,
questions.
No, I think you get Mr. Provenza, who
Mr.
actually...
Mr. Provenza for the Conservancy.
Going to talk about the Conservancy.
Don't forget Jim.
Yeah. Now, that's the last piece of the puzzle. The Delta Conservancy, of course, was established by Senate Bill 1 and is really just in the organizational stage. There's been two meetings. We have hired a temporary interim executive director. A week from Monday, our subcommittee will meet to begin the process for a search for a permanent executive director. We have other interim staff either on or being hired. We have begun presentations to educate the members as to the process that has occurred up to now. Some have been involved. Some are new to the process, so we're bringing everybody up to speed. Once we hire a permanent executive director, we will have 2 years to do a strategic plan. And as a lawyer, the first thing I do is I go to look at what the law requires us to do, and that's why I did something I know you didn't want to see, and I hardly ever do is a very brief PowerPoint. But the Delta Conservancy, what I call the Delta Conservancy co-equal responsibilities. Now, like a newspaper, the headline is mine, but the law is as written, and the two responsibilities of the Delta Conservancy are to act as the first, as the primary state agency to implement ecosystem restoration in the Delta, and then secondly, the Conservancy shall support efforts that advance environmental protection and the economic well-being of Delta residents. I think that really is the key to making this process work, the implementation process, because both of those elements can work together to make this a very successful process. We recognize that in doing a Delta plan, in having a BDCP plan, a big part of that is going to be ecosystem restoration. There is a necessity to addressing the ecological opinions and the problems with fish, and that all needs to be done. But along with that, the law recognizes that
the Delta Conservancy is responsible for advancing the well-being of the Delta residents and creating what we call in Yolo County the concept of net gain, that people work together because everyone gains in the process. Now, that term, I didn't invent it. It came from our historic agreement between the gravel companies and environmentalists that allowed the gravel mining in Yolo County to go forward. And one of the first things that I saw as supervisor is I went to a meeting that I thought that people would be up in arms and fighting each other, and they were all arm in arm working together because they had reached an agreement to protect the environment and promote industry at the same time. And that's really where I see the opportunity. Let's see if I can do this. The Conservancy will support efforts that promote the economic well-being of Delta residents, including protecting and enhancing habitat and habitat restoration. We've talked about some of that, but I think it also includes all habitat. In our county, for example, it includes the wildlife area, an area of importance to the federal, state, and national government, and a subject of international treaties for protecting migratory birds and providing a place that thousands of children receive education in the environment every year. Protect and preserve Delta agriculture and working landscapes. So we've talked a little bit about that, but that's important to every single Delta county. In Yolo County, we're kind of first up. We have the Yolo Bypass, where rice growing is a very large part of our local economy, very important to us. We are working on studies that will figure out ways that we can address the habitat restoration for fish without harming the rice growing. And in fact, one of the things that we've done recently is concluded agreements with both the water agencies and the state to fund Yolo County's efforts to do those studies so we can figure out how to have a net gain, so we could figure out how to do what we need to do to protect fish at the same time we're promoting agriculture. We've also looked at things like mitigation that would include purchase of ag easements in other parts of the county where ag land is taken, so that at the same time you're maybe losing ag land in one area, you're preserving it in another. There's a lot of ways to do this, but again, the concept and the commitment is to making sure we promote other important state, national, and local objectives. And I will say with agriculture, it is more than just our local economy. If you look at what's going on in the state and the nation, we're rapidly losing ag land. And throughout the world, agricultural land is declining. So we have to have a commitment to making sure that we preserve some agricultural land going into the future so that we don't face food shortages like we now face energy shortages. So it's, again, an important interest. But in protecting that interest, I think we can work in ways, and particularly with a conservancy, because you have local government there, state appointees, environmentalists, who can work together to figure out ways to do this so that it's a net gain in all those interests. Provide increased opportunities for tourism and recreation in the Delta, and promote Delta communities and economic vitality in the Delta in coordination with the Delta Protection Commission. These are, I think, very important roles, things that as part of the strategic plan we can promote, goes along with what Mike was saying about what a tremendous resource we have in the Delta and the Delta communities. And so making sure as we are developing these plans that we also figure out ways to promote those interests. Increase the resilience of the Delta to the effects of natural disasters such as flood and earthquakes in coordination with the Delta Protection Commission, and protect and improve water quality. I think those goals speak for themselves and will be an important part of our efforts. Assist the Delta regional economy through the operation of the Conservancy's program. Again, I think as we develop a strategic plan, we will be thinking of ways we can promote the economy at the same time and hopefully result in a gain for everyone in the process. Identify priority projects and initiatives for which funding is needed. And, of course, at this point, the Conservancy doesn't have any funding except to do the strategic plan, but the strategic plan will take about 2 years. And I think that's really an opportunity, too, because at this point, and we just went through this this process in talking to Senator Feinstein's staff and looking at some of her goals for legislation, there's a lot of skepticism right now in the Delta about funding the Conservancy at all. But I think if we are able, working with you and working with the Delta Protection Commission, to develop a strategic plan that promotes all of these interests, I think a lot of that skepticism goes away, and we go forward with support for funding, not only federal funding, but ultimately the state bond and other things. Once people see where it's going and understand that it's being developed for mutual benefit. So I think it's a challenge, but it's also a tremendous opportunity. Protect, conserve, and restore the region's physical, cultural, historical, and living resources, and assist local entities in the implementation of their habitat conservation plans and natural community conservation plans. And then finally, facilitate, take protection and safe harbor agreements, and promote environmental education through grant funding. I think those all fit into a very ambitious goal that the legislature has set for us, but I think it's one that will attract funding and attract support federally, at the state, and ultimately at the local level if it's done right, and done with a concept in mind of promoting mutual gain or the idea of net gain.
I must confess, when I read the bill, I flagged Function 11, the take protection and safe harbor agreements for adjacent landowners and local public agencies. And that of course, is essentially getting the right to take a certain number of endangered species under federal law, state law, and all the other stuff. Have you given any thought yet to the kinds of things you'd be doing under that authorization?
We have, again, the Conservancy hasn't talked about these yet. We're just in the very beginning stages.
Okay. Okay. All right. Now, any questions? Is somebody going to wrap it up? Mike, are you going to wrap? Yes, Mr. McGowan.
Just to thank, my job is to thank you again for taking your time. Maybe you don't appreciate how much it means to all of us throughout the Delta for you to hold this meeting here. We do take it as not just a requirement, but as a sign of your sincerity that you are here to work with us and to listen to us and to try to incorporate our issues. I'd be remiss if I didn't thank the ownership here of the old sugar mill, John Beckman, and also John Carvalho, who's got a winery here as well. And I was serious about sticking around if you wanted to taste a little wine, and if you feel so inclined to buy a case or two, we have it available.
Will there be live music, Mike?
Yes, but you don't want to hear me sing after a couple of bottles of wine.
So
you might want to wait on that for some other occasion. Cindy's not here, so we're in trouble.
Supervisor McGowan, I understand your band played recently at a private event in Stockton, which was somewhat raucous. And
all I want to say is that we're still working it out with the police chief there. The animals, I think, are all out of the veterinarian hospital now.
Good.
The neighboring dogs and cats, and I think most of the fires have been put out.
Got it. Thank you very much. For those of you who don't understand the reference, Supervisor McGowan has a well-known.
Legendary.
I was going to say rock band.
Legendary
rock band, and has for many, many years. And he played recently at Mr. Johnston's home in Stockton. The police were only called four times.
That's right. Anybody call your office, Larry? The sheriff.
Thank you. Let's see. Other thing is, I mean, I know you're going through the hiring of people at the Conservancy, and you've also got hiring situations at the Delta Protection.
You know anybody?
Commission.
Send them over. We need good talent there. Absolutely.
Okay. Anybody in the audience interested? There are two jobs applications going on right now.
And the deadline for application for the DPC is Friday of next week.
Friday of last week.
Of next week.
Next week. Okay.
And I think the Conservancy pays more.
Oh, you were going to work with
us on that. We're trying to work that one out.
The chance to play off the Delta Protection Commission against the Conservancy for salaries perhaps would interest some of the people in the audience. But it also suggests that if there are occasions where you want us to report into you and vice versa, I think it's a good idea.
May I say one more thing, Phil? I'd be remiss if I said there have been, in addition to our formal work as a Delta coalition of counties, I know there have been any number of private conversation, individual conversations going on between all of us and different members of your body, both staff and commissioners as well. And I've personally been very happy with that, very pleased with that. Finally dawned on us that, you know, hey, let's just start having these conversations. And I think that the communication avenues here are good and they're open, and this can work.
Okay. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Ahead of schedule. Very good.
Oh, it's that tough Mike Reagan. That's what. Thank you. Okay. All right. Ladies and gentlemen, as you notice, we've set aside 2 hours for public comment this evening because we thought some people would be coming after work and it made sense, and we're willing to stay at least till 7:30 or until the last person desires to speak, which is not an invitation for filibusters, although those are popular these days, but just an observation. Also, some of you may not be able to come back to our meeting tomorrow, which starts at 9 o'clock. We're talking about our second draft interim plan. There'll be a third and final vote, interim draft interim plan, and then a vote in August. We're talking about administrative procedural and appeal stuff. It's not for action, but for information, and there's some miscellaneous stuff for tomorrow. So if any of you are not able to come to tomorrow's meeting and wish to use the public comment session to raise issues for tomorrow, that would be perfectly appropriate. I guess we've had a couple of requests already to speak. Mr. Coolidge, I'm sorry.
Just on tomorrow, the staff report for the interim plan tries to outline how it changed from the first draft, but
right.
I should let folks know that this afternoon we posted the red line on the website as well, so if you really want to get in and see change for change, it's a little confusing to follow, but the red line is there, so you can see what dropped in, what dropped out.
And some of your communications that had come in had said you want to have a red line, which is very necessary. You're going to find that the change from the first to the second plan moved major pieces of information out, so it's going to look massive on moving stuff out. But stick with us, and we'll have the red line published of the third and final version before the next meeting, and that'll also be a red line version for your review. So anyway, who do we have? Ms. Rogers, why don't you just bring the cards up here, and if you give them to Ms. Rogers or anyone at the table, we'll call you in the order you submit an application. Ms. Sward, I'm going to give you back your book so I have an official record verbally and also in on television. Thank you for the loan of the interesting book. Thank you. Well, yes, we'll happy to pass this out. Okay.
I'd like to thank you all for taking the time to listen to all of us, too. It's wonderful that you've come into the Delta and see what it's like here in the Delta. I put on the little blue sheet this fishy news. That's what I called this, because even today there is a lot of news about fish. And I want to express that over the last 2 years, I kept seeing the news say the same thing over and over again, you know, fish versus farmer, and didn't really talk about all the other issues that you all are dealing with now. And so I did a study of the media, and the reason I'm telling you this, so you won't experience the frustration I did in realizing that so much of California media, the news media, has gone through this huge transition of ownership in the last year. More than half the newspapers went into bankruptcy, went into reorganization early 2010. And so we have very few people list. I mean, if you go through, you have to go, there's, I have a whole lot of research on this, but I knew you guys were overwhelmed with information. So I just want you to realize that there are most of the newspapers are controlled by very few people, and so if you see the same story over and over again, There's, you know, just a few choir directors, so they're all singing the same song. So when you read papers, you know why. And that applies to the online content, too. And if I have the verification of all the different stuff and, you know, who owns what now. It's pretty amazing. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Swart. Okay, the next speaker is Ms. Carpenter-Sarah. Pardon? I'm sorry. Okay, my apologies. Please come forward. You could either sit down or stand up at your pleasure.
Okay, this is fine. I'm Judy Carpenter-Serpa.
Could you get near the microphone? Some people in back can't hear you. Thank you.
My husband is Daniel Serpa. His family has been here since 1849. And we have here to show you, I can read a little bit of the start of it, but the family was started by George S. Miller from the Azores Islands. And he brought several people here from the islands. He landed on the Lisbon district, which is just north of us here. You're right now in District 999, but just over Winchester Slough is 307. We farm in 307, and we own property here in 999. George Miller came here in 1849, and he bought up a couple hundred acres, which happens to be the home ranch of us that's directly across from the pocket area. And the family's been farming there ever since, and off of Winchester Slough and Pump House Road. So I brought these today, if anybody wanted to look at them. The Dutra family, the dredging family of Rio Vista, did this as a service to everybody that's in the family. And we go back the eight generations. So I'm going to read you this, if I could, for just a moment. Joseph S. Miller, this is the genealogy of a dredging family. He was born March 6, 1822, on São Jorge, Azores Islands. He bonded to age 13. He stowed away on a Boston-registered American whaling ship from São Miguel, the Azores Islands. And he whaled for 14 years on the California coast as early as 1835 in Monterey and San Francisco. In July of 1846, he arrived again on the California coast. Then he arrived again on July 2, 1849, in San Francisco. And he settled in the Lisbon district on the west bank of the Sacramento River, 6 miles downstream from Sacramento. And he married Josephine Paravagna. They purchased the first 186 acres, he did, before he married Josephine, and the swampland in the Lisbon district. Now, that's where we farm, in the Lisbon district. It's about 8,500 acres there. He converted it to prime river bottom farmland and raised a family of 10 children. He died in Sacramento on July 4, 1899. But what everybody needs to remember here, he was instrumental in the migration of many of the family members from the California members from the Azores Islands to California. I got to read to the end of this and come back to the front, so excuse me, bear with me here. So he was instrumental in the migration of many of his family members from the Azores Islands to California. And also, prior to 1849, he made two transcontinental trips across the United States, personally accompanying his Azorean relatives to California. Now, what I have here, this is pictures of them. And it starts with George Miller, and it goes all the way into the Dutra dredging family, comes up here to the Lyell families, the Alamo families, the Freitas families, and naturally us, the Serpa families. That's why we've been here for eight generations. My husband would be here today, but he doesn't have the patience. He just can't understand, and everybody out here knows who he is. He can't understand why you want to come and maybe make this a swampland. We grow grapes for Gallo, Behringer, Sutter Home, and he started John here in the sugar mill. So to take that away or even a threat to him is just, he just can't understand it. So best I come and talk to you guys and say how important it is that we keep this here, all the way from District 307 to Rio Vista to the Dutra dredging family. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Melinda Terry, you're in the back of the room. There you are. Ms. Terry, who came with us on the morning part of our tour.
Melinda Terry, California Central Valley Flood Control Association, and I'm just going to limit my comments to respond to Mr. Nerdoff had mentioned the vegetation on levees and wanted to make you and your staff aware that SAFCA, who is one of our members in conjunction with the DWR, the Army Corps, and National Marine Fisheries and the other resource agencies, are in fact studying the vegetation on levees and whether they really do pose a risk to the levees, or does removal of the vegetation pose a risk to the levees as well, including doing everything from literally uncovering a root system of a tree that might be next to a levee. You can't believe what they've done, and even toothbrushes, and kind of gotten down there and looked, and then to check to see whether they go into the slurry walls that do exist in that those levees. They're pulling down trees to purposely see if that will affect it. So my point is they could come make a presentation to you, or at the very least give you the information of the scientific work that they've done. Or your independent science board actually may want to meet with them. That might be a better suggestion.
The report is likely to be finished at what point in time?
It's finished, I would say, probably sometime next year. The framework agreement that we have on the vegetation right now is only good through 2012.
But some of the work is going to be done in the interim, so
seasonally.
Before we have to adopt our Delta plan. Okay.
But is it done by November when you want to do your Delta plan? No.
What area? Well, no, the November is just the first of, I think it's four or five different drafts, so there's time to go beyond that. But when where is the area you're they're doing the study?
They're trying to hit all different areas.
So representative areas throughout
the... Yes, they could give you the actual locations.
But it's also the Central Valley Flood Management Area.
It's not just the Delta, correct.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And will their area... excuse me. Will their areas include areas in the Delta?
The last meeting I had with them, they were asking me, in fact, for locations. So okay. I assume that they did go to those.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, Ms. Terry. Okay, Steve Herringer, for whom we have to say thank you. Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you, Chairman Eisenberg, and a welcome to the committee members. Appreciate very much your willingness to be here. I am.
We thank you for accommodating us with this room. It was, I know, a big problem for you to move this around to get this many people here, and it's a terrific accommodation and works out quite very well.
This is the barrel room, and it's used for events just like this, for wedding receptions. It stays like this most of the time, so you're welcome here anytime.
Thank you, sir.
I'm Stephen F. Herringer, fifth of six generations of the Herringer family to farm Clarksburg soils. Many families in the Delta have farmed for multiple generations, and over the years have grown a large variety of field and row crops. We've had to evolve and adapt our operations in order to maintain economic viability to ensure the sustainability of the family farm for future generations. During the past four decades, growers have planted over 17,000 acres of our Upper Delta region to premium wine grapes. Our crops have proliferated in quality and yield, and the Clarksburg Delta has earned a reputation of being the banana belt for premium wine grapes among Clarksburg wineries. We have heavily invested in our vineyards, which have a life expectancy of 25 to 30 years and can easily stay economically viable for up to a century. In 2005, the UC Cooperative Extension published costs to establish and produce wine grapes in the Clarksburg region. The study documents the requirements of in excess of $16,000 per acre to develop a vineyard. And during the past 5 years of dramatically increasing steel, vine, labor, and fuel costs, that investment can easily be in excess of $20,000 an acre today. That equates to a total investment in vineyards and infrastructure alone exceeding $340 million in District 17, the Upper Delta region. California Association of Wine Grape Growers completed an economic impact study 2 years ago of California wine and grape growers' contributions to the state and U.S. economy. Extrapolating these economic impacts to just our 17,000 acres of wine grapes, we create in excess of 11,000 full-time equivalent jobs in California and an additional 13,500 jobs nationwide. And that is more than the Obama administration has been able to generate. This generates $357 million in California wages and almost $900 million in wages throughout the USA. In excess of 700,000 visitors with tourism expenditures exceeding $71 million are attributable to our 17,000 acres of grapes. Our Yolo County supervisors have partnered with us to keep our unique Upper Delta area agricultural. We adapted sustainability generations ago to assure the farming and enjoyment of our Delta region for the benefit of all of the people of our great state. We respectfully request now that you consider the Delta as a place and its people in all of your deliberations. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Herringer. Appreciate that very much. Okay. Mr. Robert Kirtland. Mr. Kirtland, there you are.
Good afternoon, members of the board. Let me adjust this here. As my cousin Steve pointed out to you, I also am a fifth generation of seven generations. Family came for the gold rush. Didn't find the Golden Mountains, but they found it down here. I would like to point out to you folks, and may I inquire, poll the board a second. You know, when I say how many generations we are, for our community, that is not unusual. I'm not an exception. I'm the rule down here. The board, how many of you are from a multi-generation California family? Just raise your hand. Very good. We appreciate that type of historical perspective. But my operation, Diversified Row Crop, Agritourism, and I am a nationally recognized speaker on agritourism, as well as kind of a self-appointed historian of our area in the Delta here. In fact, last week I was a resource speaker on the water education bus. But I'd like to point out several things about our Delta. For a little background, this book is called The Siskiyou Trail. It's the historical adventures of the Hudson Bay Company down in California, which, by the way, was given to me by the Moore family, and also a multi-generation Gold Rush family. And in it, they talk about when they came down in 1830, they found really a jungle, berries, tules down in this part of the valley. Even the Indians only lived on the natural water banks along the Sacramento River. About the only animal that could get through the underbrush was the grizzly bear that they occasionally encountered. But they talked about in this book, when they were shooting for game, one shot would raise so many mosquitoes that it would block out the sun. And in the winter of that year in 1830, it rained so bad that the only dry spot they could find to camp was the Sutter Buttes. It wasn't 6 foot of water, 10 foot of water, but this whole valley was wet. And the Sutter Buttes, as everybody knows, was the only place that they could camp. In 1850, which, by the way, when they returned in 1833, it's described in the book, they found a valley of death. They had brought malaria with them. And, of course, we all know what spreads malaria. And they pretty much wiped out the native Indian population in this delta. In 1850, California became a state. And part of the conditions of it becoming a state was all these lands, public lands, had to be given to the federal government. And as most states, these lands were handed out through federal homesteads, never passed through state hands because, you know, when they were a state, they were a republic when they gave it to them, except when it comes to swamp and overflow lands. Swamp and overflow lands were given from the feds to the state government with the condition that these be sold to private individuals to become beneficial to the state by reclaiming it. Our families, many of us down here, were some of the recipients of these early patents. We actually have a contract, And it's handwritten, and it's held in the archives, a lot of the libraries in the counties, that these lands were granted to us free and clear of the common law public trust in three areas: navigation, fisheries, and commerce. Because these had to be passed that way. The state gave up these rights way back then in order for us to be able to turn this land into a beneficial use. So, you know, we're dealing with a lot of historical perspective here. What was very interesting to me was that after I got done speaking to the Water Foundation, I get home, I get a phone call from my aunt. She received a packet for state wanting to come onto her lands, which is across the river from one of the intake place proposals. And I noticed on there that they have a channel margin, which was talked about 20 years ago, folks. It's nothing new. It was 20 years ago, but everybody thought it went bye-bye. That channel margin, if enacted, would wipe out my family's heritage and a lot of these others, because in the early days, that's where we built our homes and established our families and operations along the banks of the river. My home that I live in was built by my great-great uncles. The last flood in, and I also live in Lisbon District. The last flood in Lisbon District was in 1907, which, by the way, Lisbon has never broken from the front levee, always through the back levees, because the levees north of Sacramento would fail and come through the back. My home stayed dry in 1907 because of the location that it was built at. But I think, and I hope it was not just lip service I've heard here, because, folks, we definitely need truth in government. You know, we hear a lot of talk, but we don't see a lot of action. And I would like to finish with one thing, which I talked to on the bus, and I'm very serious about this, folks. In our fire volunteer fire department over here, we have a roster of honor, a roll of honor, which were the men and women that served in World War II to defend this book that I'm holding up, this beautiful old leather-bound book. And it says Constitution of the State of California. 1941 is when this one was printed. The foreword was written December 7th, 1941, 4 days after Pearl Harbor. But I want to read to you something that our men and women fought for and continue to fight for. Article 1, Declaration of Rights of our state constitution, not the federal. All men are by nature free and independent, and have certain inalienable rights, among which are those of enjoying, defending life and liberty, acquiring, possessing, and protecting property, and pursuing and obtaining happiness, safety and happiness. Folks, do you know I paid for that book? $5 in a used bookstore. We're getting from our government that those words do not mean what they say. So I ask you, before you act anything, honor the contract that my forefathers and a lot of the people in this room entered into. We honored our side. We've made these lands some of the most beneficial and productive in the world. And, you know, you talk about the best use of water. Show me where else that we can pump water out of the Sacramento River using our lands, then our neighbor picks it up and uses it again, who knows how many times, before it's returned to the Sacramento River. Do not destroy our heritage, as well as one of the most productive, efficient agricultural areas in the world. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Kirtland. Mr. Peter Stone. Mr. Stone?
Well, I thank you for the opportunity to address the council. I live and work in the Delta, approximately 1 mile from here, but it's on the other side of the river. It's very interesting. The community here is, for me, my personal experience is unlike a neighborhood in the city or in an urban surroundings. You know, your neighbors are a few doors down. My neighbors may be 5 miles down, but they're only a few doors down. So I view, if I want to go and do something in the Delta and I live 2 miles south of Freeport, I don't go necessarily just up the block to Pocket or to Elk Grove. I go 20 miles down to Walnut Grove. I go 10 miles down to Cortland. And there's such an interesting community that I've never experienced before until living here in the Delta. And I'm a first-generation Delta person. But I really appreciate the history that's here and what I see in the beauty of the Delta, the farming that goes on my property. I've got a very small farm. And have appreciated just what we just heard, the tremendous care with which each of these reclamation districts were assembled and put together to actually do recycling before the word even existed, and to take and reuse the water. I've been told that this is one of two inland deltas. I live near the Mississippi Delta, and you think of the Nile, where they just spew water out into and silt out into the oceans. This is one of two inland deltas in the world, and the other one's in China. And I just, you know, love the, you know, it's funny at our place, you know, we live right near Stone Lakes Wildlife Preserve, and the birds over there, you know, we get all kinds of flocks. They must not read the signs because they like the farms. What I find is the environments created here in the Delta are ones that, where the wildlife, the endangered species, can interact and work with, particularly the land-based and the birds, really love this area. We've been involved in the Delta here, both sides of the river. Our sons have been Eagle Scouts, two of the over 100 here in the Clarksburg Troop. We've worked hard to rehabilitate our 120-year-old farmhouse, and as was just mentioned, there are these temporary entry permits coming, and you know, I represent one of the few people who, when you look at the BDCP maps, I'm the first intake. The intake as proposed today is where my farmhouse is, the 120-year-old farmhouse. And as I look at that, we had a meeting the other last week in the town of Hood. There was a time when some of these maps were put together, there was not even an understanding that Hood existed. And so they said, oh, there's a town there. And you know, as you look at it, the town of Hood is a half a mile across from Highway 160 over to the bridge there. And the channel, if they do the above-ground option, takes out a half of the town. So you get to pick which, because I've been told it's 1,000 feet to a quarter of a mile across. And there's certain things that have just caused, I've been to a lot of these public meetings that have been held in the BDCP, and I really, as one person said earlier, really applaud and appreciate the fact that in the charter for your group that there's a focus on, you know, working in terms of with people as well. Because one of the things that was absent in so many of the meetings that we saw was we knew that everybody's rights were going to be protected except the human beings that lived here in this area. And so that's been a real concern for many of us. And then, I enjoyed the discussion on the science earlier. It seems like there's a lot of conflicting science, and I found that early on. The DWR guys were really frustrated that they do everything they can to clean off the inside of the levees so that they can find the boils when the water is rising. And for those of you who've not lived here, when you find a boil on your property, the water is coming up, not from the levee, but actually coming up right next to the levee. They can't do anything about it at the time. They have to actually make a well around it and get to the point where they just stabilize it until they can handle it later. A lot of very interesting things that just don't work in a similar way in the city, and I'm sure many, many of you are aware of that. But one of the other things is then you've got DWR on this side, and they're frustrated with the fish and game folks who won't let, you know, anything be done to take the things off the levee on that side. And, you know, that conflicting science concerns me also when I think in terms of the conflicting legalities again, are the laws, if we've got conflicting laws in terms of rights, who are they going to be, adjudicated for? And so we see many, many times it's all the Endangered Species Acts and all the other things which are important, but the laws and the rights that people have seem to just be going by the way. And one other thing that just wanted to touch on is, even though all the intakes are on the east side of the river from basically my house down to Cortland, when you think about that Freeport intake facility that you saw this morning or this afternoon, I wasn't there, but when you think about that has 290 cubic feet per second. And the ones they're talking about putting in are 3,000 cubic feet per second. So what will happen is they talked about being 8 stories tall and perhaps a half a mile in length. And putting those kind of facilities right in the heart of the Delta isn't going to do a whole lot in terms of having it be a scenic place. We're putting industrial commercial facilities right smack in the DAPA, in the middle of a very beautiful, beautiful area. So with that, I just appreciate the opportunity, and thank you for listening.
Mr. Stone, thank you very much. Okay, we've got some other. Anyone else like to speak? If you'd fill out a form, that would help us a lot. And we've got one more request only so far. Mr. Pruner, there you are, Mark. Members, you'll recognize Mr. Pruner from many previous meetings if you've been down to the Delta, but also, I think, 3 of ours.
At least.
Good to see you again.
Thank you. Some of the other members of the community are coming and filling out cards. First of all, I want to thank you so much for coming to Clarksburg. You're in the primary zone. Now the statute says you got to be here, at least in the Delta. But thank you anyway for coming. And many of the members of our community are here to participate in the process, to watch what goes on, because as you can hear and hopefully you can feel their homes, their businesses, their lives, they feel very much are affected by what you're doing and will be doing. And we've been here for a while. We've been meeting at North Delta Carers for 2 times every month. We've been doing that for about 2.5 years, coming on 2.5 years, and we hope we don't have to do that too much longer, but we'll continue to be engaged and meet as long as it's necessary. One of the things I want to point out, I think it's a great example of what has happened here in the Delta with the energy and the focus and the community, the people here, is the facility that you're in today. This sugar mill was built in the 30s at a cost, I understand, of over $2 million, which in the 30s money time frame was a lot of money. It's a lot of money, of course, today. But it was built in the Depression, and it was surrounded, after it was built, by sugar beet fields and processed sugar for America, if not the world. You can see out there a bag that's on display that gives you an idea of what came out. And I'm sure the owners and proprietors here would be willing to take you on a tour of what's on the other side of that wall, and you'd find an old, massive factory. But as time goes on, of course, the old facility became not as economical to run, and it had to be closed down. And that happened about the 80s or so. And today it's been reused, and it's been brought back to life again. And that's not unlike the entire Delta. That's not unlike the families that you've heard so far talk and share. And that's not unlike the banner that you'll see up front with evidence of many, many, many families who have been here for generations upon generations. I haven't lived in the Delta for generations. My family came to Tulare County in 1835, so I've been in California for a long time, just not in the Delta. But we've been in farming, and we know quite a bit about farming and what it takes to run an operation. I'm just so thankful this is a place that I get to live. So I want to say thank you for coming. And I asked Keith and Chairman, I think I spoke to you and some of the other members asking you to come, and you responded and you came here. I very much appreciate it. Thank you for having this portion of your meeting after work so that the people who aren't paid to work on Delta stuff but volunteers like myself can come afterwards. And I would like to ask you, please, to come at least once a year as long as you're around to this great facility And as Supervisor McGowan said, we'll keep the wine purveyors open for you, and do everything we can to make you feel at home. So you'll hear from some of us later on, and you have an important item tomorrow on the agenda, and
right.
You've scheduled 5 hours for that discussion. So
yep.
Thank you very much. And I think
thank you, sir.
I've been filibustering for a while, so I know some other people want to speak.
Oh,
and
we'll
need to fill the card
we'll just,
out. So
we'll do a general invitation for.
We want to make sure we get the process done correctly.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, any of you like to talk to us if you haven't filled out it? Whoops, okay. Bob Berger. Your handwriting is just as bad as mine, but I think it says Cortland for something Hood.
Well, I was pretty proud of my handwriting until you said that. So, I'll just... maybe title myself as a squeaking wheel that would like to get a little grease.
Yes, sir.
I've been to a good number of these meetings. And to give you a little bit of understanding of my background, where I come from, I grew up on a farm in Kansas. I'm not a several generations person here, but I am some generations. I'm 77. And the reason we moved to Hood, and by the way, I want you to know we didn't think that was the most attractive place on the earth. We moved because of our family and because of the environment. I grew up on a wheat farm in Kansas and a dairy farm. I went in the military and served 7 years just for people like you. And now when I look at this and listen to what I've heard today again, repeated, I have to ask myself over and over, where is the heart in all this? I hear all this stuff about the science and about this, and you've heard it all. I don't want to repeat your whole litany. But I'm not angry at you all. There's no anger doesn't settle anything. But I have this desire to say to you, I left the farm in 1952 to go in the military. I'm a retired pastor. I've spent many years serving people. And if you don't have the heart of the people, you don't have much. Our whole government in this country does not have the heart of the people. Why can't you help us? As I go to these meetings, I always go with this thing in mind. I'm the chaplain of the fire department, the Cortland Fire Department. And I always go for two reasons. One, because I have a family here. Peter Stone's family first came in the end of the 90s. And there are 20 of us here now, right here in this neighborhood. And as I look at it, I say, I came here because my heart. I look around at the things that you're talking about doing. And I think, what can I take back to my family and to say, what is the hope for the future for them here? What can I say to the people in Hood? What can I say that will encourage them from anything I've heard here today? Give me some words of encouragement about these young people growing up in our neighborhood, never having the chance to reestablish themselves in a place that they grew up in. What do you have for people at my age? Came here to retire, enjoy the time, and just wonder, right now, if I put my house up for sale, I couldn't get half what I paid for it in 2001. I couldn't get half. I couldn't get a buyer because of this very thing. How much time have you spent asking yourselves, what can we do to encourage the people in Delta? Besides have us come up and give our overtures of your thanks for being here. I have an overture of thanks for you as well. But I will thank you when these things cease to exist and allow us to be the kind of people that we have been and want to be, that contribute to a community that is stable. This community is not stable now. The whole country is not stable. Our whole economy shows that. And here we are hearing all these plans. We're in 2 years, 1 year, 3 years, all these things. And what can I go back and tell my family about their future here? What can I tell them? You look at that map and see where that thing goes through Hood. And you tell me, what can I say to my neighbors? Some of them were in my house yesterday saying, what are we going to do? And I had to say back to them, what are you going to do? And I trust they will do what I'm doing. Speak up. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Berger. Mr. Richard Bagby. I believe it's Bagby. Mr. Bagby.
I'm not a farmer in the area. I'm a retired educator.
Yes, sir.
And I've only been here about 40 years, but in that 40 years, I've gained tremendous respect for the people who are farming in the area who are true stewards of the land. They're people of integrity and people are doing the right thing. I come here today representing two groups. First of all, the Clarksburg Community Church. I'm one of the trustees. The Clarksburg Church here has an impact within and beyond the community. Informally gathered as in the early 1920s, they were incorporated in 1926, built their first building out of pocket in 37, added on to that in the early 50s, and just recently completed another addition to the building. The Clarksburg Community Church's mission locally extends free of charge to many community groups. The fellowship hall in the church is known as a community hall because it's available to all groups in the community. As far as worldwide missions go, we've reached as far as Jaramillo, Mexico with material, money, and labor. We've had our people in Bucharest, Romania, again, with money and labor. We've supported many other worldwide missions. My concern is that any intrusion on the vitality of our area, the way things are, would adversely affect our support structure, which is entirely volunteer donation, and make many of these things not possible. I also am Assistant Fire Chief, Clarksburg Fire Protection District. We have an outstanding fire department. I think we do. We're well respected in the county and beyond. We've achieved ISO protection class 5 for many parts of our community here. And again, we're relying on our tax revenue and fire assessment here in the area. That's the sole source of income to make protection and safety possible. Any intrusion on this business, residence, farming, is going to adversely affect our financial base and thereby affecting the quality of life here in the Delta. Please, gentlemen, whatever you decide in the future, come on down to Clarksburg, look around, talk to a few people, and include that in your decision-making process. Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. Next speaker is Mr. Bob Weber. Mr. Weber? Bob Weber? There you are, Mr. Weber.
Good afternoon. I'm Bob Weber. I'm the manager.
Pull that mic up a little bit so the folks in the back can hear you, please. Thank you.
There we go. Maybe that works better. Bob Weber. I'm the manager of Reclamation District 999. And I just wanted to educate you a little bit. Reclamation districts are an integral part of the farming operation. We were formed in 1913. We have a board of 5 people that runs the district. We have 33 miles of levees that we maintain and operate. We have 260 miles of ditches that provide the drainage and also the irrigation water supply for our ag operations. So it's critical that the local government agency, which we are a critical tie to the economic viability of the area. And I've got a history of the district, which goes back into the 1850s for the board members.
If you give the ladies your copy, then they'll put it. We'll also put it in the record and post it on our website if that's agreeable with you.
Yes, that would be fine. Great. That's why I brought it. So we hope that you'll, you know, look at the fabric of the Delta and our history and how it really works. These are the boots on the ground. We take care of 26,000 acres with 3 guys. So it's very, very efficient, the structure of local government that we currently have, and we would like to see that continue forward. Thank you.
Good. Thank you very much. Mr. Brett Baker. Mr. Baker. I couldn't hear you. I'm sorry.
Tomorrow.
Okay, that's fine. That's fine. All right, is there anyone else in the audience? I think we've got no other blue slip. Anyone else like to talk to us? If you want to, just come on up. Tell us who you are, and if we need to spell your name out by asking you to fill out a form, we will do that later. Yes, ma'am.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm much too old to remember all your names, so I'm just going to call you ladies and gentlemen, and say very much thank you for being here today. I'm quite sure that I am about the oldest person in this audience.
Can we have your name, too?
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Jane Klotz, K-L-O-T-Z. Okay. I've lived in Clarksburg for about 50 years, but my family has had a history of agriculture. My grandfather came across the plains in 1862. He was poor as a church mouse, and he and his family built a thriving farming business. My own family were professionals, and I married into an agricultural family who raised cattle. And I can tell you, ladies and gentlemen, my husband taught me to recognize BS wherever I found it. Having lived as long as I have seen our economy go up and our economy go down. I'm sure that a good many of these people have seen it go up and down also. But having been born during the Great Depression and having survived it, I have learned a great deal. And one thing is, you cannot base your economy on something as appealing as real estate, housing, because it's not rewarding, it's not truly essential, and what it does is give people a very false sense of values. The economy should be based on something that is as solid as raising food, because people have got to eat. Now, you have an awesome responsibility, and I'm sure that everyone here recognizes that times change and our system has to change to some degree. But basically speaking, the economy is going to perform for us sometimes well, sometimes not so well. When you are a farmer or a rancher, you realize that times aren't always going to be good. The rain's not always going to fall. The grass is not always going to grow. The bugs may land on you and decimate your crop. This is a given. And if you're a good rancher, a good farmer, you will plan for that. You will know that when the times are good, you had better save for when the times are not so good. And if an individual farmer or an individual rancher forgets that, he doesn't stay in business very long. Neither does a government. Neither does an economy. It's all the same things. During the good times, you had be better prepared for the bad times. Now, when you're coming to thinking about what is going to happen in the Delta, it's not just Clarksburg, it's not just the towns on the river, but it's the whole state of California, because I hope that you'll agree with me that we are in a very, very bad situation. And it's not going to get better until everybody realizes that the fate of the farmer is what is going to determine the fate of California. Somewhere along the line, we forgot that. The Golden State has been golden because there's a goose that laid those golden eggs. When you start to strangle that goose, pretty soon you're not going to have any golden eggs. The water is vital to the ranchers. Without it, they cannot raise a crop. They cannot feed people that need to be fed, not only here, but throughout the world. If that water is given out hit and miss, and that the ranchers cannot count on the amount of water they're going to get, they cannot plan, they cannot succeed, and neither can the economy for the state of California or the world. I do think that I'm glad I'm not in your position. I'm glad I don't have to make these decisions that are going to be so vital. But unless it's recognized that people's in their swimming pools or their fountains or whatever is more important than the water that goes on the crops that feed people, we're going to be in a very, very bad situation. Give the ranchers, give the farmers an assurance of what kind and how much water they're going to get, and they can feed the world. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Clark. Thank you very much. All right. Is there anyone else who'd like to? Yes, please.
Good afternoon. I'm Karen Metters. After listening to a lot of the history and the multi-generations of people talking here, I'm sitting here thinking about the BDCP and the plans. But in addition to that, I'm thinking about the alternative options that you guys will be considering. And there are good plans out there that deal with flood management, flood waters, flood plain. There's out there that would have a net increase in water deliveries to the Central Valley and the South of plus in dry and drought years. But my point is to spend more time exploring all of the viable options to conveyance, not just a tunnel and not just a canal, because as you can see up here, we have history that established well before the state of California ever came to be. So with that in mind, if you can hold that in the back of your minds as we move forward in this process and give extra attention to those alternative plans. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, anyone else? Anyone else? All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to start again tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. We'll start promptly at 9 o'clock. We've set aside a very big block of time for the interim plan, but we're going to do a panel discussion. I think you find it on the agenda material, focusing particularly on flood risk, levees, and related questions. And everybody we talked to about this meeting suggested that that is likely to be certainly not the only subject, but probably one of the most important subjects. So we're going to try to focus our discussion on that. This is, as we mentioned, some of you did come in later, so let me mention this again. We have a draft interim plan that the legislation told us we had to do. Didn't tell us much what it was, but it's a draft interim plan. That is not a legally enforceable document. It is simply a planning document. Separately, by no later than December of 2011, we have to adopt a Delta plan, which is a legally enforceable state regulation. There will be for the Delta plan four or five draft iterations and a full environmental impact report. It's going to be full of so many bells and whistles you don't believe it. And that will occupy most of our time from September all the way through the deadline period. And that's the statutory deadline given to us. The interim plan that you'll see tomorrow is really kind of a structural, foundational document for that. It's worth a lot of your attention. We have now, or will have tomorrow, red line copies showing the difference between the first and the second. My personal impression is it's shorter, which is good, but also more understandable in the second version. There will be a third version before our August meeting, posted on the website and available for everyone. For those of you who use computers, we urge you to sign up on our list so you get the automatic computer notices and access to the stuff the minute it's available. And we will work as hard as we can to lead up to that August meeting where we're going to be voting on the interim plan and procedural rules and so on. So anyway, we're going to be here for 5 hours tomorrow on this whole thing. A lot of focus on flood control, levee stuff, and emergency response. And I think that's hopefully of interest to you, as it is very important for us to explore. Members, anything else for this evening? Okay. Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Natoli.
Just very quickly, Mr. Chair. I know a lot of folks have thanked us, and you certainly have thanked folks for being here, but I certainly would like to just to second that in thanking folks for being here. Some have followed this very closely. Others have made a real point to be here, and I think that, as we've heard, we'll continue to hear some very compelling testimony relating obviously to the very important work that's here, but I just would join with others in thanking folks certainly for being very very hospitable and welcoming us to this community. And I think it's reflective and representative of the communities throughout the Delta and certainly throughout the state, and I think people feel very strongly about many different items, but there's a lot of common interest, and I think as we go about our very important work that I think remembering some of the comments here this evening that relate to general considerations and certainly some of the specific references will be very, very important in our work. So, again, I just wanted to offer that as we close this afternoon.
Right, and I should have mentioned it before, but I didn't. All of our hearings are not only public, but they are essentially simulcast, so anybody with a computer in the world can access and see exactly what goes on. Let me assure you that we check carefully, and this facility was one of the ones that's made it possible with its computer capacity to do that. And that's really remarkably different from when I started in elected office, where you had to wait for paper copies to come out and nothing was ever filmed, or if it was, you found it 2 weeks later. And so slow as this is, it is so remarkably speedier than what I experienced many years ago. It's a marvel. Also, we post all of the written comments received on our website. Give us 30-60 day to try to get our revised and better website up. Information's there now. You got to work to find it. We'll make it simpler and better. We'll see you tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. Thank you very much.
Eddie waited till he finished high school. He went to Hollywood, got a tattoo. He met a girl out there with a tattoo too. The future was wide open. They moved into a place they both could